about what's going on the legislation perspective as well as what's going on the technology front. So our members, just to remind members of this committee, are small members. We don't have big infrastructure. We simply don't have all the technology backing in order to have the ability to make sure that the requirements that are required for legislation are in place.
Thank you, Israel. I'm going to continue in the slide. I see the security chief has joined us again. The slide says what's going on. And I think back to the original slide, we just need to touch on what is going on in the sector and understand that all of that also impacts on what we call small business. So there is a flood of regulation going on. There are efforts to transform the industry, and there's been quite a bit of mention made this morning already about technology and by FASA. All of that is impacting significantly on the small businesses as well, and it's also impacting on clients, and it does bring new challenges. I think the picture which people may have that you have people in dark corners sitting behind closed doors, that is one side. There's another side which is different, and we need to also understand that that is impacting on people who want to have a beautiful business. We've just simply listed a number of areas where we're seeing changes in regulation. And Madam Chair, I want to say to you from where we sit, this is daunting. You have to ensure that your members are compliant. We are forced to do consumer education, which we support, and we believe that more needs to be done in that space. We are proud partners and work well with the bank sector in the space of training. Renoco, in fact, is our representative on that board. And all of this is putting a huge burden and challenges on small businesses, which we believe are still existing after 21 years because they actually serve a real and a true need in the market. I think we have to, for a moment, stop and talk about the technology. The technology, I think, is a massive enabler for the processes of transformation. We are certainly not into the mode of bank bashing. All our clients are effectively also banked because in order for them to participate in the broader financial system and also to take up regulated and legal credit, they need to have a bank account. The inability to access technology would effectively disintermediate people from the market. So in terms of what is in the hands of people and what is in the hands of consumers today, exchange because of technology, we believe that it's made life also easier, but it certainly also brings certain compliance challenges. Having said that, in terms of our broader industry, we made some mention, and Israel made some mention in terms of what is happening in the industry. I think the point we need to make and the point we really want to drive home is that our members have access to training via the bank sector and also internal initiatives. We are part and parcel of consumer education initiatives, which we believe needs far more attention, and we could possibly never ever do enough. And then, very important, although we are in various actions with and together and against the regulator, all our members need to be registered with the NCR. So let me be absolutely clear about that. We are in support of a well-regulated financial services sector. We encourage and enable and empower our members to do so, but we are also faced by the other side of the market. So in no way will we support a market which is not regulated. So we have a couple of concerns which are very, very high level we'd like to deal with The first theme is, and I'm going to probably do it with some anecdotal stories of time and hours, the incentive for people to transform, especially people who are loan sharking today, and then we share the sentiments of COSATU and the SACP, there is very, very little incentive for them to transform. They probably have worked out mechanisms to beat the system as it would. You've heard that often. I think people become blasé when they hear it. We have seen a significant tick up in illegal operators, and we can go into the regions in a moment. The sustainability of our industry to us is key, and in terms of the barrage of regulations we have to meet, the sustainability of many of the administrators, we have seen a significant drop in our numbers, and we also have seen with current operators that they have that have had to and are in the process of retrenching stock. I can also say that in the environment of the many adjustments that we have to make, that the practical transformation agenda sometimes falls off the table. We are concerned about consumer awareness. Although great efforts is done by various departments, 20, DTI, National Treasury, the banking fraternity, ourselves, others, I don't think we could ever do enough. I honestly don't believe we could ever do enough. And an educated consumer is a far better investment from our perspective. And those who abuse people who are not able to understand documents, we are absolutely against that, and we also, in fact, escalate those problems to whoever further. The issue of the unbanked has been spoken about, but what I want to raise, Madam Chair, is that we as providers in the financial sector who are representing small businesses, we certainly need to have your support. And really, my plea to you is that the generalizations, when we talk about non-bank credit providers, specifically those of providing short-term unsecured credit, to simply talk of everybody as if they are exactly the same, I think it's an unfair generalization, and I really think it's not in the interest of consumers. If consumers cannot distinguish between people who are regulated and subscribe to a code of conduct, then everybody becomes the same, and they actually end up in the hands of those who are creditors. So a couple of things that then need to be done, and I'll make my talk. First of all, I think it's crucial that we must monitor the formulated regulations and how they are being implemented. I will take questions on that if it seems well. I've made my point about education of financial services, and then in line with the previous speaker of the lunch, the rural areas is a concern to us. People are far away, consumers are not necessarily educated as you would like them to, and there are rogue operators who simply say, catch me if you can. So we are absolutely committed to looking at our own house. We are very open to concerns that are being raised. But I think it's also fair that we, as small business, being more aware we do the good thing and we do the right thing, that the necessary support is there. And over-regulation is an absolute challenge. Having said that, in terms of our commitment, we are 100% committed to continue to work with you. You've seen me here often, Madam Chair. We've had our differences, but we're happy to be here, and we will continue to work with you. In terms of our support, we would like to see a sector that is functioning well. Very important, we would like to see competition in the market. We are the small guys. We have to compete with the big guys. We're happy to compete with them, as long as it's been done in a fair way. We believe consumers should have choice, and we believe that the best way of protecting the market is to actually ensure that they have choice. And then we need to understand that we are also an employment generator, and we support that with all that. So what we then say is we're clear that we fight to grasp that subject. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you. And then we have the Center for Competition, Regulation and Economic Development. I what about for you?
Point out that What we need to know there really is that for lower cost bank accounts, on average, you pay fees half across banks. If you look at what's happened in this period here, which is significant. We saw similar trends in terms of telecommunications sector, when regulators actually took the risk and were contested by firms in the legal cases, etc., that took the risk to say we're going to change mobile call termination rates. What you saw is that you saw significant reduction in data and pricing for calls and services in that industry. A similar thing can happen here if regulation is sufficiently followed. I won't go into too much detail on these issues around barriers to entry, except to say that they are quite clear and many of them remain. Issues around consumer switching is obviously to do with the behaviors of the consumer themselves. However, it's also to do with the extent to which we put information out there to consumers that allow them to compare service offerings and to essentially basically pull the maximum benefit out of their service providers, which we argue is not at optimal levels at this point. There have been improvements in terms of levels of transparency, but we still have issues around, for instance, the fact that the only way to access consumers, or the primary way to access consumers, is still through ATM infrastructure and traditional models. Whereas I think it's high time, and our comrades and our kind of colleagues across the continent have demonstrated that you can pursue boldly alternative ways of giving people financial services, and that experiences around mobile money, etc., are very good examples of this, which I'm happy to speak about in the questions. In terms of the bank collusion, I think just to maybe I should have mentioned in the beginning that our particular expertise or experience also draws largely from having worked with the competition authorities and for the competition authorities as well, and so it's probably apt for us to comment on these issues, even if only briefly. It's important to characterize the cartel as part of a global cartel arrangement. And to recognize that the extent and the scale of this collusion, this particular cartel, is almost quite unique. What importantly highlights in our South African context, however, and our consequence that we have to deal with, is a severe lack or weaknesses in the extent and the nature of our supervision of our banking enterprises. We learned nothing essentially from the global economic crisis, to the extent that many authorities around the world spoke about market conduct, regulators, and closer scrutiny. And yet the banking cartels across the world hit us again over the last 3 years, starting in the US and the UK, etc. And so those are issues that I think point straight to the regulators, and particularly to certain departments, I suppose, that are responsible for these aspects of supervision. The fact that we've had delays around the market conduct regulator and those bills, I think, is a significant concern, because again, the outcome of this is not that we have to come and discuss this again a few years down the line. The outcome is that consumers have lost out in this process in terms of the collusion that has resulted, and that's of significant concern. Importantly, I suppose, just briefly in terms of the cartel theory, and something to note here is that the competition authorities are limited in their ability to address these issues. They may conduct investigations, but the current legislation limits the penalties which are liable for this conduct. However, overwhelming evidence in Europe and other countries will show you that cartel benefits and profits are far greater than the penalties that any competition authority, and we're not alone here, is able to extract. And so there needs to be follow-on measures to deal with the consequences and the effect and the excess profits that have been drawn from this collusion, which I think is not being spoken about currently in the discourse, except to use it as a tool, I guess, to talk about the political issues surrounding the sector, which I think are just as important. And so here we're saying there's an opportunity to use this instance. You know, we've got an open door here to use this instance to talk about opening up regulation and to reposition the issue around market conduct firmly in the center of the work of this committee, but also the work of regulators and departments in this space. All right. And so our kind of catchphrase around these issues, and this study is situated amongst a set of other studies that have looked at barriers to entry in, you know, for Selfie case study, Soweto Gold, and beer production, agro-processing firms, etc. And so there's a body of work here that's available on our website, CCRED. But just briefly here, we've also looked at mobile money and the experience of the countries and done comparative studies of that. And I think while there's obviously very unique kind of characteristics of the South African market, it's important to note that to some extent regulation was an important contributor the slow uptake and the difficulty in allowing these types of products to gain traction in our market. So what does that mean? It says, well, if we fail in terms of introducing these products, do we kind of throw the whole thing off the table? Or do you have a rediscussion about what needs to change, where we can change it, through our existing regulatory tools and others, to enable more diverse plurality of models of accessing financial services? It cannot be that the only way to gain access to means of saving and loans, etc., is through four banks. And institutions surrounding them, obviously, as other members of the Payments Association, etc. Importantly to note here, and this is an overwhelming finding in terms of the case studies outside of the country, is that where you've seen success in, for instance, mobile money, is that it's been through very flexible, adaptive, and risk-taking regulatory environment. So this kind of stiffness that we tend to experience in the South African environment, which is very much biased towards stability, etc., which is incredibly important. I think we all agree, however, that with the very smart minds that ensure that stability, I think we've got enough smart minds to really start thinking around how do we allow the system to accept new diverse models of competing in this sector without impacting in terms of risk and the kind of indicators that the bankers are obviously very much more concerned about. I think this is an important contribution in terms of thinking about how do you move forward along with issues around cooperative banking, agency banking, branchless banking, etc. It cannot be that the only way you can access your bank is through a branch or through an ATM. There are alternative means, and I think upcoming developments in the market are pointing in this way, but that's simply not enough for an economy of our size. And I think just maybe to echo a point that's been mentioned earlier, and the last point on that slide is that there has been slow progress in terms of bank inquiry recommendations. I think that was a very unique opportunity to take on some of the more, man on the street issues around banking, which is the transparency of fees, the cost to the consumer, etc. The penalties are accrued when you can't switch bank accounts. And we have done well in certain aspects in terms of publishing fees, etc., but we've lacked in certain other aspects as well. Why this matters, of course, is that if you are talking about entry, if you are talking about a fiasco with more different banks coming in, including, if needs be, a state bank, then even those banks will face the very same set of barriers to entry, including restrictions around or limitations on customer switching that your Capitec and others have experienced. Right? And so until we address those issues, you may legislate a new bank, but that bank will suffer much the same issues and constraints as your existing firms that have been able to move into the market have suffered. I think this might be my last slide. So then I think it's clear, even from today's discussion, that there's a significant gap in terms of the information available, I suppose, in terms of ownership and control of banking structures. I think a very simple question that we couldn't answer is repeated by the EFF, and I think it's an important one. It points to the fact that there isn't enough publicly available standardized information around what is actually happening in terms of transformation in these sectors. And also factors such as, for instance, scoring and measuring and the publication of information around which banks are funding businesses.
It's now 40 minutes.
All right, cool. To the extent to which banks are, and I speak broadly about banks, are funding small businesses, black-owned businesses in South Africa. That information is incredibly hard to come by in a way that's comparable. And I think, as you mentioned, Chair, where your assumptions are clearly stated and you can actually compare meaningfully and see if you are actually making progress. Importantly here, we're situating transformation in banking in this discussion not only in terms of talking about the four big banks, although they're a big part of it, but it's saying that we have an economic challenge in the country that's far broader than that. If you think about industrial policy considered broadly, it speaks about all forms of policy and not just something looked after by the DTI, which points in the direction of supporting the growth of the industry. That's actually a broader definition of it. And so that would include, and this is incumbent upon the people that deal with these issues in the different departments and that would include regulation around banking. To the extent that regulation around banking is not supporting an industrial policy or NDP stated goal in terms of creating industry in the South Africa, then that's the question that we need to be asking. Those are the issues that we need to bring to the table. And I think as well, and I suppose this is incumbent upon regulators, is that we have within our existing framework also the tools to make some of these differences without major kind of policy issues. Because I think change happens very slowly in the sector, certainly from our observations. You kind of move at the pace of the last adopter, I guess. Issues around tiered and kind of stratified banking structures have been on the table for long enough. I think it's time that these issues actually hit the ground, to the extent to which we want to have a different conversation in 10 years' time about what happened to our banking and finance sector and whether it has or hasn't contributed to the growth of the country. Right, and so just lastly then, just to recap the point, that we've situated the issue around transformation in banking not only within the context of our own study, which focused on the capital case study within banking, but also to say transformation in banking is actually really very much about an interplay between various policy frameworks, and there's many more that you could add to that. There's this issue around innovation and technology and the extent to which our existing legislation, which is not a banking sector problem, it's government that's this legislation, is enabling in terms of different models of competition and different product offerings coming into this market. The information out there suggests that we are restrained in that regard. And I suppose this is linked to the points around retail banking. I've mentioned that competition policy by its nature is limited, and perhaps the question is whether we should broaden its ambit, or alternatively whether measures within the banking sector should be used to deal with some of the market conduct issues that have arisen.
Thank you very much, Mr. Polakazi. Interesting paper. Thank you. We then, members of both committees, we have an opportunity to raise questions. Let's stick to the two-minute rule. And I see the Honourable Williams on my left. Yes, and this, the Honourable Mkongi. I'm looking for all the other names here. I know your first name, but not necessarily your surname. Honourable Mania, 3. Honourable Shivambu, 4. And Honourable Lee. Top him. Right, thank you. In that order, please.
Thank you, Chairperson. I have questions for the SACP, the FSCC, and FASATU, and it's the same question. The question is, what are your two main proposals to Parliament around transformation in the financial sector? Then my question to the MFSA is, what percentage of your members are 100% black-owned? And my second part of my question is, other than the code of conduct that you subscribe to and registration, what are the three main differences between yourselves and loan sharks? And my last question to the CC Red is, to what extent should the penalties be adjusted so as to be a real deterrent to the dodgy dealings of the banking sector? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Williams, Honourable Mkongi.
No, thank you very much, President. I think some of my questions are in line with Honourable Williams. It's for COSATU, SACP, and also the research of Mr. Villagal. What are the strategic proposals that you think that from now up until 2 years to 3 years to come we must do in terms of dealing with legislation? What areas we must concentrate on? For an example, if you go to VET proposal, they propose that we must tamper with the legislation on competition to deal with the market conduct. One of those issues would be punitive measures, amounts, and so forth. Do we feel that all these amounts are going to deter this proposal, given the muscle? Here in the morning, it was presented that three times, the financial sector is three times the GDP of the Republic of South Africa, and the banking sector is 100% more. Now, don't you think these people are able to invest that money for any other penalty that they can give? So what areas is jail term increment for executive, or what exactly is limited from our own legislation that does not make people to leave? This is over to you.
Thank you, the Honourable Mania.
Just two light-hearted comments. I couldn't help noticing that the SACP, which stands for Financial Sector Reform, last had a campaign on this issue 17 years ago. They also seem to be in some kind of ideological turmoil. And let me say that we'd be very happy to support your campaign for deregulation if you support our campaign to extend financial services to the poor. Just then, on a light note, I wonder if Patrick might tell us which one of the big five banks, which he so likes to bash and wants to nationalize, he actually banks with.
Thank you, the Honourable Mania. Honourable Chopin. Chopin? You're just looking for a mic, okay?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Firstly, for the CCREDD or whatever, I thought that their submission was quite interesting, and I definitely plan to read the document. I think we might learn something from it. But specifically, maybe a question more to the point. From that, all that research, give us one thing that we can do to lower the barriers to entry to facilitate the entrance of a so-called black insurer or a black bank into South Africa. One substantial thing which will help lower the barrier to entry. And then I wish I'd find something positive, Madam Chair, so I thought I got some good advice for Kosasu, how to make $1 million. I think they can give us a substantive paper on how to lower the interest rate charge, how to lower bank charges, how to increase the payouts to depositors, at the same time never to fire anybody, and buy back 49% of their shares. If they give us that paper, I think either the Nobel Prize in economics will pay you out, or Trevor Noah will use it for some. So thank you, Matt.
Thank you very much. And I'm really sorry that you had that challenge, Honourable Topham, with the equipment. Honourable Shivambu?
Thank you very much, Chairperson. So if you try to cross a river with a bicycle, comrade Soli, and you don't do it, you fail to do it, you don't say, I'm going to fetch another bicycle. The bicycle which I tried to cross the river with is defect. Like, it's beyond doubt that the approach of using summits and transformation charters to change the economy has dismally failed. We had a summit 15 years ago on the financial services sector, took resolutions, and none of those have been implemented. There's been like dire progress in terms of that. And then you say, as part of your proposal, that you must call another summit. And then you must adopt another charter. Same approach. It's not the correct mechanism. I think at a dialectical level, you would have known that. Let's look at the vehicles. What mechanisms do we use to transform the financial services sector? Instead of relying on the same instruments that are blunt, that have failed this month, spectacularly, to transform the economy, I think that you must rethink your solutions in terms of how you want to approach the whole situation. And legislation which is enforceable could be one of those elements, and then we then oversee that that legislation is implemented on transformation of the financial services sector. I think that could be much more clear. I think COSATU was not supposed to present, they never said anything. There was all over. The coalition campaign as well, we did not hear what they said, but the Center for Economic Regulation and Economic Development failed to build the relationship between bank ownership control and the services that are given to the people is worrying, because you can't touch the fact that banks are owned and controlled by white people in the majority. And it's not fiction that they utilize race as well to determine whether people gain access to credit, to other financial services. It's not fiction, it's a reality that characterizes all banks. So you can't say, no, the someone on the street now doesn't care about who owns the banks. They do care, because they are going to be racially categorized by financial services by them. It's one of the issues that we must look into in totality and ultimately come with legislation that is going to save us from the current crisis.
Thank you. you, Honourable Shilambu. Thank you very much. Certainly, the Chairperson Karim would also like to raise a couple of questions or make some comments.
Yeah, I know, because the time is not taken up for some reason. People are flagging. Maybe because they're old compared to me. Yeah, Comrade Solomon, I must apologize. I forgot what were the questions the Politburo asked me to ask you. I left the list at home. So I have to stop into my A, the question. But on a more general, on a more serious note, that was very serious, on a less serious note, I just wanted to ask all the stakeholders here if they want to comment on the, you know, not enough has been said about cooperative banks, the state bank that is being proposed, and the post bank. And if they have any comments, particularly about cooperative banks, what they feel National Treasury, DTI, government, parliament should do to encourage the growth of cooperative banks. The other is a practical one, colleagues who are members of parliament here. The rule is we are exempted from the House, we are marked present, right? But because of the electronic signature problem, between now and 7 p.m., not all of us at one go, obviously, we should slip out and ensure that we've just pressed our attendance and got back. But we will forward the names, obviously. Thanks. That's a practical matter.
Yes, I think that would also be useful for the next presenters, etc., to take account of a couple of points, such as bank regulations be viewed as contributing to the goals of various issues, not simply industrialization, which is in our area, but also in other areas, to note that impact as well. Thank you. So, yes, indeed.
Yeah, just one other quick thing, for what it's worth, it's my personal view. Mr. Vilakati, I like the way you summarize it, such a pretty direct way. Whether I agree or disagree, lots of questions are left unanswered in this format. But I think the key points that you make, they're very nicely done. I like the way you presented it, so thank you very much for that.
Yes, it really is a solid sort of presentation for a short space of time. And it's useful to get text with it as well, which I'm sure we will. But
this is not to say that Comrade Solly's input wasn't the best in the session.
Now, we have had a lot of substantive input, haven't we, Chairperson? Yes, indeed. we are going to have just a slight change here due to flight challenges. And I understand that the actuaries, Lachotla, is this correct? The Black Business Council has agreed to swap with yourselves. Is that right? So if you would come to the fore then, thank you. Oh, yes, of course. Well, you see, you're so much better at this than I am. Now, let's... yeah, right. Can we please get the responses? Thank you. Who'd like to come in first? Microfinance.
So we had a question from Honourable Williams, which I think picks up on some issues which I would have liked to have dealt with in any case. In the presentation. As far as the ownership goes, we are small businesses. We've looked at our figures. We're talking about roughly, in the membership base at this stage, about 30% black-owned. And I want to then delve into that matter. And what I'm sharing with you is absolutely practical and not anecdotal. You must keep in mind that there was a threshold which was removed and set at zero for people to register with the NCR. When that was in the run-up to the removal of and the change of that, we started engaging with several parties, including the NCR. And I think there was a perception that people are going to rush out to report and then to register. The practical reality is that when people come and we speak to them about what is required to regulate, to be registered, what are the requirements they have to meet, the investments that they have to make in time and training and systems, they disappear. They decide not to join. We to the answer what should be done and what could be done for that particular grouping of people, with the small guys who are battling to come through, or who have just, let's say, moved into or broken into the formalized area of small loans, unsecured and secured, short-term and unsecured. Their plea is absolutely for training, education and empowerment of themselves to do the work and to do it right, and not to pay the school fees 4 and 5 times. I can quote you from our conferences with the regulator in the room where they would stand up and say, please don't prosecute and close us, educate us. So the process to me should be, Madam Chair, with respect is, first of all, dissemination of the information which is required to register, then to aggressively educate, and we are involved in projects with the bank sector, then maybe, if need be, a period of amnesty for guys to get their house in order and come out, and then if people do not want to toe the line, we say prosecute and deal with them harshly. That's our thinking, and we're public about that.
All right, is that it?
The question about banking and the comments that we made, the main reason why my members would want to have a banking license, if you could overcome the regulatory challenges and other requirements, is the access to deposits, which is a more affordable type of investment than what you can search out in the market. But the moment you enter that space, you're into the Basel requirements, the capital requirements, etc., etc., and that in itself then makes it expensive. Because your basic money in our market, which you bring in, is expensive, it affects the pricing of the on-lending, and you also have to then measure that against the compliance requirements. So the decision to become a bank, to me, the biggest responsibility is that you will protect those deposits. And to protect those deposits is an expensive job. So that is where I think the trade-off needs to be made. Certainly quite a number of my members have looked at it over time. Many of them did not see their way open to go that route. And many of them have exited the market in total. And they've left the financial services. I in fact got a message while I'm sitting here about another big guy just left. So there is an exit from the market because of the tightness, and it's a challenging environment, as I need to say. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Who's coming in right now? Will that be the South African Communist Party?
Well, I can answer from here.
Right. Sure, yeah. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, just 2 points. The first main task is that we need to dismantle the banking monopolies as they stand today, to the extent that they control the bigger market share of the sector. That means diversifying and transforming the sector by bringing in a strategic role of the public sector in banking services, as well as cooperatives and other sectors. That is why, for instance, the issue of the immediate granting of the post office license, a banking license, is very important. The other key area is around differentiated policy for the sector, particularly the coming sector that we have argued for. But unless we have that intent by legislation, just creating a possibility for them to come in, they get easily swallowed by the big commercial banks, the plain sharks that are already existing in the field. That means differentiated policy should have an intent for diversification and transformation. I think also another critical question for us is the banking clearing house or the central payment system, which at the moment makes it difficult for your cooperative banks to have an independent role instead they become subsidiaries of this the big role player. The question around community reinvestment is extremely important for us because it can divert a lot of resources that can deal with national priorities without necessarily the sector losing anything. In fact, it's a disgrace that a sector controlling 8.9 trillion rand cannot actually build the country and take the children of this country to school. But if you have an appropriate legislation, you can force the banks to do that. And another key area, particularly for the role of the sector, is about taking active role in the radicalization process of transformation. And that is why Comrade Floyd, it's important that the summit seat is not a one-stop solution, multiple solutions. For instance, we don't know how long the legislative process will take. We can't wait for the legislative process to actually be completed. But at the same time, it will accord an opportunity for all the role players to come together again to review the previous charter and to collectively agree on the failure. And I think that at that point, we believe that the state should be able to assume a more strategic responsibility and role on the basis of non-commitment or non-implementation of commitment by the sector to push ahead with radical measures that can force the sector to transform. Of course, I must indicate that in that case, therefore, it's not a political thing. The philosophy of our party is based on dialectical materialism, which argues for interconnectedness of things in their interconnected process of change, a continuous process. So, but I think we continue for our campaign, no doubt. We launched it in 2000. It has continued in multiple forms. For instance, our campaign for the granting of the post-licensed bank is a part and parcel of the same campaign. In 2008, for instance, Minar Khan can actually indicate that despite our major role in the creation of the National Credit Act, in fact, no other political party in the country lobbied for it in public than we did, which actually saved our economy a great deal when the global finance crisis meltdown affected many developing countries. So we have continued the campaign. The campaign is not static. It takes different forms, including many other submissions and so forth. but the bottom line is that those are the key main areas, and the campaign continues. Thank you very much. And I think next time we'll invite him to part of our activities, and I hope you'll accept the invitation.
Indeed, we must empower everyone.
Right. Okay, Polly, can you just explain to the House who was the first employer of One Floyd Shivambu?
Of course, I gave him his first employment. He worked in my office. And I must say, I'm very proud of him. I'm very proud of his work. I must say that he may have jumped at the floor, but I'm very proud of him.
The project gone wrong.
That may well account for the very erudite analysis we get on this from the Honourable Shivambu, who's written a very interesting paper recently. Right, and anyone else who wishes to comment here on the matter? No, of the presenters, that is, that have just come up. But I think it was Kasatu.
Coalition,
of course, yes.
The financial sector coalition. Chair, I will be very brief. Covered in most respects. The question was, what are the two main proposals we would make? And indeed, in the written submissions that we have provided, we went to some detail. Safe to say that the most important contribution we'd like to make here is the need to reconsider this kind of gentleman-like agreement that is based around the idea of self-regulation, to say that we have had ample evidence over the last 15, 17 years that it doesn't work, and it's not going to work, and what is required is that we are not going to preempt the outcomes of the financial sector summit as it is coming. We are not going to do that here, beyond just saying that that summit will enable us to identify the actual areas of intervention that are required, as was the case 17 years ago, because if the FSCC, working with Mossad to the SSCP and so on 17 years ago, did not call for the summit, we probably may not have had this conversation today. So we are very proud that of what has happened in the past, and we think that the second summit will enable to take the country further in a very decisive way. Thank you very much.
Thanks for noting the Payments Association of South Africa as well. And then we also have Kasatu and Mr. Falakazi. Kasatu? Is that yourself, Mr. Park?
Yes. So I'll just be short, Comrade Chair. I think Honourable William, Mkongi and Karina had very similar questions. I think, Chair, look, if we were to give a couple key proposals to the Honourable Members, I think I'll take a gap. Since there are three members, I'll say five proposals, not just two, Commodore Williams. I think one is, number one, the State Bank. Let us finally see its fruition. I think, Commodore Chair, you know, there's a famous saying that don't let a crisis go to waste. The social crisis, let there be a chance to bring the post bank to life, whether it's in 6 months or whatever time frame is reasonable. Let it be the one which distributes the social grants. And we build up its capacity and its access in rural areas and so on. And it can link up with the idea of a cooperative bank. I think number two, Chair, would be the issue of consumer rights, the issue of bank charges being excessive, or the issue of access to banks, to branches, to ATMs in rural areas and informal areas and townships. I think also, Chair, the abuse of auctions for people's houses and cars and small farms and so on. I think, Chair, our trade union, SASPO, the Banking Workers Union, has probably got more members than most political parties. And I think they wanted to raise the issue of the wage gap in the banks, the issue of retrenchment and outsourcing. I think, Chair, there's also the issue of the anti-competition penalties, which are far too small, in providing space for smaller entrants like VBS and others to enter the market. I think, lastly, Chair, is around the issue of crashing loan sharks. And I think, Chair, also the Trade Industry Committee's initiative around a bill to provide debt relief to the highly indebted consumers with legitimate grievances and so on. I think, Chair, to Honourable Toppen, look, nothing is impossible in life. If we had said if something is impossible, we would still be living under apartheid. Chair, you have banks making billions of rand of profits through bank charges. So therefore, there is space to reduce bank charges. Those are theoretical charges. They're not based upon the price of bread or the price of a brick. The theoretical charge that I'll charge you 150 rand a month to have an account. Chair, we can't say you must have a retrenchment of 2,000 employees in ABSA. Yet the CEO, according to Elizabeth, in 1 year makes about 30 million rand total cost to employment. So surely there is space to reduce top salaries to save the ordinary cashiers and bank tellers and so on. And I think, Chair, lastly, the Barclays selling of the shares in ABSA is a golden opportunity for the PIC to buy shares, keep those shares in South African hands. So again, there is opportunity, it's very easy. The PIC has done fantastic work over the years and so on. I think, Chair, the Honourable Shivambu, yeah, look, it's disappointing for the EFF to say workers' issues are all over the show, it shouldn't be raised. But perhaps, well, we shouldn't be surprised because the EFF is also all over the show in coalitions. But we do welcome the EFF to the committee meeting in Parliament. It's a very rare occasion to see them. But I think for last
year... That guy wasn't too much.
Right.
We'll throw you out of here.
Can we please...
We're in charge.
Have you finished, Mr. Park?
So the last question, Chair.
Have you finished, Mr. Park?
Just the last question. In the interest of transparency, the Honourable mainly asked me which bank do I belong to. I belong to ABSA. I think I was attracted by the red banner. And I was quite disappointed when they sold shares to Barclays. Thanks very much.
Mr. Right. We do still have the CCRED, but is that correct that you wish to add something, SACT? Yes.
Yes, it was a point raised by Comrade Yunis about what the DPI and the Treasury can do. We think the main important thing that they can do now is to roll out a provincial footprint for the cooperative movement and avail funding, as well as to make sure that the new agency that is to be established is an activist agency, and there's massive potential for it to grow and transform the sector drastically. That's what we wanted to add. Thank you, Ross.
Thank you very much, Mr. Filicardi.
Thank you, Chair. I'll touch briefly on each of those questions. I think in terms of the extent to which penalties can be adjusted, so the benchmark or the rule of thumb around cartel markups, so the overcharge, the extra profit earned on through cartel conduct, is international studies are suggesting around 15-25%. And so that gives you a benchmark or a sense for what we're talking about when we're talking about the excessive profits earned relative to the penalties that are charged. Having said that, however, the competition legislation is very specific that a 10% penalty is relevant to the total turnover of that entity in the Republic and exports, but it's of the affected turnover. And so, for instance, if a particular division of a company is guilty of or responsible for this particular kind of conduct, as in the bank collusion, then a higher penalty can be levied as long as that penalty, higher than 10% that is, can be levied as long as that penalty is not necessarily larger than the 10% of total turnover of the enterprise. The Competition Commission will be hearing this case in the tribunal, and I think it's certain submissions around this issue should be made to motivate for higher or lower penalties in that case, and that evidence is considered. In terms of areas to focus on, from a policy perspective, I think our policy brief, which is a four-page note, but also the report outlines a number of areas that we've picked that can be addressed. But just to highlight that, I think there's a legacy of the banking sector inquiry recommendations, which I think are low-hanging fruit that can be dealt with, to the extent that we are concerned about, again, the pricing and the customer-facing experience of our people in terms of banking. In terms of reducing certain charges and penalties, etc., there are recommendations there that are still yet to be fulfilled. And then issues around licensing and supporting of entry. So to the extent that regulatory burden is overwhelmingly against small entrants or smaller entrant banks and cooperative structures, etc., and that's an obvious important area to look at, because I think, as I mentioned earlier, where we've seen the most diversity and change in outcomes in our banking sector has been when there was a global financial crisis, but also followed by a period of entry and a bit more disruption in the sector that took place in the last sort of six to seven years. In terms of one barrier to entry lowering incentive initiative, I think there's many, in fact, and obviously they relate to the two points above, but also issues around switching. I think the economics of it is that you can build a state bank tomorrow, you can build any bank tomorrow, black-owned or otherwise. But if you can't pull customers, and if you don't understand the behavior of customers, and if there are restrictions and constraints in your ability to actually get customers off, and you experience this in telecoms as well, then that bank will not have customers. And so it's not to say that if you establish a bank tomorrow, we'll have customers for it the next day. So the issues around switching are just as important as thinking around the next point, which is issues around ownership and control. So just to be clear on this, one of our research processes currently ongoing is actually understanding the ownership and control of firms across the JSE. And so that's very much close to what we were proposing here, but I think we narrowed it to a simple set of issues for this purpose. The real question here, or the parallel question, is whether, if we're talking only about ownership and we think that's the end game, then whether we're prepared to wait the 10, 15 years it may take for all the banks and all the firms in the country to reach a level one status before we say, right, now go and deliver affordable, cheap, accessible, dynamic services to our people, or whether there are interventions in the interim, so some of which were proposed in the banking sector inquiry, that can be made to start to reduce the cost burden and improve the customer experience of banking, which is still lacking very much in the sector. So it's a question of trade-offs, but there are also smaller interventions that can happen in the interim to make services available in a better way while we address issues of ownership.
Thank you very much. Thank you. And at this point then we go on to the exercise, the next section, which we discussed earlier, and that is the actuary's lachotla. The actuary's lachotla, followed by the BBC.
I'm just getting my iPad. I have my own.
If you just give us your name, thanks.
Yeah, we'll do. Aushen, hello to all of you. Aushen means hello in Tonga. That's my language. Just trying to get my iPad. You say I had to respond, but anyway, I don't have a lot of time, so I should get going. So thank you, Chair, for the opportunity to present here today. I've listened to a lot of the older, more experienced people and people who run companies. I think it's fair to say that as actually the quarter we formed of young people, and we'll probably be giving a more on the ground sort of scenario into what we think about transformation. So my name is Melusi Baloi. I'm a qualified actuary, and I'm part of the leadership of Action Zikota. So as Action Zikota, or AL, we fully support and appreciate the work that's been performed by SCOF, or the Standing Committee on Finance, and we'd like to, if possible, continue to engage and provide insights where we can. Just to kind of talk through about what I'm going to look at, I think I would like to highlight that in our view, as actually the thought that we look at situations where people are within working for established companies, as well as people who are trying to establish their own companies, and looking at the challenges that they face in terms of transformation. So I'll introduce actually the quarter, and then look at the major transformation roadblocks that we see. Comment briefly on the charter, and then look at legislative roadblocks that are there for SMEs. So firstly, actually Zikota is a forum for actuaries that was created last year. We made up of young actuaries working in the financial services sector in South Africa. Our vision is to empower, to celebrate and encourage black actuaries in South Africa. AL is making this submission because we are very frustrated with the slow pace of transformation or de-racialization that is experienced by black people as well as women in the financial sector. In order to just briefly explain what actuaries do, if you do not know, I will just quote briefly from Mr. Cyril Ramaphosa. He said recently of actuaries, "Your work informs how we deploy our resources, our financial resources, how we manage risk, and how we prepare for the future." So I think that sort of encapsulates what we do as actuaries. Just to get into this because of time constraints, I think it's fair to just say upfront that our experience is that there is a lack of deliberate attempts to drive transformation from the perspective of companies and other organizations that are in positions of power or influence in order to change the situation. And this also includes, by the way, the Exterior Society of South Africa, which is very untransformed. So if you look at its council, it's mainly white males. And I think that there's a lot of excuses that we find when we try to engage to understand what's being done in order to change that situation. So by engaging here today, we hope that we'll be able to get some help and also maybe to just contribute to transformation in general. So we think transformation is strongly evident by, among other things, a lack of a single black chief actuary for the major companies this is, lack of statutory black statutory actuaries, alternative statutory actuaries or head of actuarial. These are the senior roles in companies as far as the actuarial profession is concerned. As actuaries of Hota, we have taken the following actions today in order to try and solve the problems that we face. We have engaged quite broadly with actuaries, especially black actuaries, to try and understand what their challenges are, to gain insights and also to assist them in solving those challenges. We have also engaged with the actuarial society, as I said earlier, and it's fair to say, without any fear, that we've been frustrated by the lack of action or even any coherent sort of solution when it comes to the engagement that we have had. I will now move on to the major transformation roadblocks that we find. And the first one is that of unequal pay. This is a huge issue because we have seen biases certainly against black people or black actuaries and against women within the industry. We think that for all the people, for each person who does equal work with another person, there is no reason why they should be paid less. It's absolutely wrong to do so, and we think that that should stop. So first of all, just to kind of give some evidence, we have seen a report by 21st Century, which does salary surveys for actuaries, and this has actually confirmed that black people are underpaid across the board. So what distresses us most of all is that the conversations that we have had with senior people within actuarial departments, we have found out that they actually know about this report, and there has no action that has been taken to try and correct this. And we think that that's wrong, and we think that there should be certain actions that should be done to try and correct that. In terms of suggestions, we certainly think that companies should be asked to justify pay discrepancies where these exist by race and gender, as a matter of a standard statutory submission every year. And also we think as and when the government requires companies to provide this information, companies should oblige. They should be willing to show and prove that they don't have these sort of biases within their own departments, or at least to justify why these sort of disparities may exist. We think that it's not so shocking anymore to have this sort of thing, because recently Iceland has been wanting to have this sort of legislation to say that people should be paid equally regardless of the classes or race or gender, etc. And we think we can learn from them, because if we don't, what happens is the people on the ground are continuously frustrated by companies. And at the end, you don't want another revolution to be coming our way. The next roadblock I'd like to discuss quickly is that of opportunities or exposure. What we have found through the forum that we have as actuaries before that is that there's a tendency to deny opportunities for black people and women in companies, so that they can grow into senior positions. And as you find, as time goes on, you find that these people are not ready to go into positions of influence, because at an earlier stage, they could have been given an opportunity, but they were overlooked. And then you find what happens at the end is this whole aspect of, well, you know, this guy is not ready to get into a position of leadership. But it was deliberate racism or sexism that would have led to that kind of scenario in the first place. Excuses range from, you know, the individual is not a culture fit. So if I am black and grew up in the rural areas, and my manager is white and grew up in Santon, there will obviously be a disconnect that exists. And we don't think this is good enough to stop individuals from being given opportunities. So we'd like to suggest that the charter at least adopts more stringent kind of measures to try and fight these two stumbling blocks of pay. and as well as opportunities. I'd like to just discuss mentorship as well, because we think this is key. So if you look at the majority of actuaries, of black actuaries coming from poor backgrounds, and their managers mostly white, there's a natural disconnect, as I said, and we think to be able to bridge that gap, you need effective, targeted, and actually deliberate mentorship in order to help these individuals to get into positions, into senior positions. So that is actually an imperative if we want to fast track transformation. And if I may say, we have seen that a lot of companies do have black CEOs or black people sitting on the board. But we on the ground, what we see is the layers that exist between ourselves in terms of positions and those particular CEOs or those board members. And it's very difficult to be able to raise concerns. And we find that these concerns are mostly blocked somewhere in the middle and they never get to reach the top. So we're actually quite disappointed, because what's the point of having a black CEO if you're going to then suppress the people on the ground when they have legitimate issues that they need to be solved? So just to briefly comment on the specifics of the charter, we realized that by reading the report that there's a very, very disappointing 5% engagement from companies when it came to the 2013 review. And this is quite worrying, because then where is the 95%? What is it that they're hiding that they don't want to reveal? I mean, certainly, in our own minds, we think that these sort of people should be forced to comply, should be forced to meet the targets that are set in the charter. If naming and shaming is what it takes, then we suggest that it be done. Another way is to require companies to say publicly if they do or do not comply with the charter, because effectively this is a self-regulating sort of system, because then all those investors and the people, the stakeholders into those companies will then know whether or not these companies meet the requirements for transformation. One thing we noted is that there is not a lot of awareness of this charter, and maybe there is a case to say a bit more promotion of this charter should happen, because then what happens is if I know that the company I work for subscribes to the charter but doesn't meet these requirements, then I'm able to engage and try to see if there's something that can be done. And lastly, we don't think we should rule out finding companies that don't meet the target, because if they resist against what you're trying to do, then sometimes it might help to actually do that, to find them. And the second aspect we would like to comment on is that of using salary bands as a category for putting someone into senior management or something of this sort. An example is if you earn more than 450K a year, then you consider to be senior manager. And these numbers we've seen from companies. The numbers we're seeing from companies actually include those sort of people. So I earn that much money, but I don't have any influence in the company. So how am I senior management? Because I cannot even control the decisions that happen or indeed the allocation of resources. So we think that this sort of thing encourages fronting and it should be corrected. And the last bit is to look at legislation as far as it affects SMEs. We think that SMEs can contribute significantly to transformation and job creation as well as economic growth. So any sort of legislation that we have within the sector should be enabling for these SMEs rather than crippling them in a sense. So if you look, for instance, at the high capital requirements for life insurance companies, the new regulation that's yet to be implemented is actually moving the minimum capital requirements from 10 million to 15 million. So now how does that help SMEs in this environment where we're looking to transform? So we suggest that should not happen, that the capital requirements should be kept at 10 billion, and that there should be programs that target SMEs and help them to be successful. And lastly, we think that the issue of audit firms being rotated should be pushed hard, because audit firms will never be rotated. They will always circulate between the big four unless these companies are forced to do so. And we think that this would be able to help SMEs as well. And in conclusion, I'd like to just quote from Oliver Tambo, a great South African, who said once that racial discrimination, South Africa's economic power, its oppression and the exploitation of all the black people are part and parcel of the same thing. We think that pay disparities and biases on opportunities based on race and gender amount to sexism and racism, and there's no place in the financial services industry. And we should do everything we can to root out those sort of things. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I had just left when you gave us your name. Is it Odishe Maglala?
No, actually it's Melusi. So if you look at the presentation, the first name there.
Melusi?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Good, thank you.
Thank you very much. And as you know now, we're going to do the BBC, the Black Business Council.
No, Madam Chair, thank you very much. I just said to the introduction, as I said to the Chair, that I need to start by saying we hope after we made this, some of the members will protect us beyond this, so we are not abused like we were after we made the ticker bill. And we came here with the ticker bill, and then when it went to the main presentation, Honorable, I forget his name, Mania, abused some of us in Parliament. So we need protection, we respect this body, and we also need to be protected.
We are here, don't worry, we're here.
We need to be really protected. But we are happy to be here, and we'll be a special feature all the time, so they must get used to it. And first, I must say, it's been an interesting morning, and we want to reiterate some of the things that were said by the members of the EFF.
Three conversations going on the left. Can we refrain? Right, thank you.
Oh, okay. Okay, sorry, I'm Danisa Baloyi, this is George Sibulela, and it's Silora Taba. Yes, we believe that these hearings are very important. Indeed, it is why we were formed as the Black Business Council in the first place, challenging some of the key regulation and lack of transformation in many of the sectors in our economy. But today, I'm not convinced that we are shifting enough. We still believe that, unlike what was said earlier, large size still means power, and power breeds monopoly and control. We believe that finance is the navel of our existence. We can shout, but without money, we don't have a voice. Our voice becomes meaningless, because those who are
who are powerful indeed have a bigger voice. We also believe that he, and pick up that I'm saying he, who controls the country's purse, controls the economy, the country, and its people. We don't believe that there can be real shared growth, inclusive growth, because to have that, those things that we will mention later as activities or things, some of the key activities that need to happen are in place. We also believe that it is wrong to look just at performance, because that's what we are told, that if we tinker with some of what is in place, South Africa will go daily up. We believe you can still change, transform, and manage to be inclusive and still make the money that you want to make. We also believe that it's so many years later, why aren't we innovative enough to allow my grandmother, who puts her 1,000 rand into her banking account, to also have a say in what happens in the banking system. So to the legislators sitting in front of us, we believe you have the power to change. You have the power to help us deracialize the economy. You have the power to change the rules of the game. Because as one of our past presidents said at the BBC, if you don't have the marbles, you can't play the game. We can stand on rooftops, but we can't change anything. So our presentation is in line with what our president said. What do we mean by radical socio-economic transformation? And it's there. Anybody can see that. But also it becomes confusing when we also come up with statements like that, because then it creates a dichotomy and it creates a discussion in the public arena that causes confusion. Needless to say that we don't quite agree. We want to highlight that we agree with what was said by former Deputy Judge Museneke, saying that it's about time we created new banks and new businesses, and that's our push. We believe that we do need the guts to do that. We've never looked at transformation as taking away from anybody, but it is about making the pie bigger, and it is possible. I want to reiterate what I usually say, is that we're pleading to the financial institution to deploy some of the cash that you are sitting on to stimulate the growth of this this economy. And lastly, before I hand over to my other colleagues, I would like to say that it is possible for the financial institution to create a change in our country. We believe that by doing that, you will create new wealth, you will create new players. And unless we do that, we said it last time we were here, there will be upheaval in this country that we will not stop. All of us need to play a little role, and it doesn't matter if we come here and flash numbers. and say there's 24% owned by black people on the stock exchange, if it doesn't make any meaningful difference to the person in the street, to me running my small business, then it is meaningless. So we're pleading for everybody to look at the numbers and make them make sense to the average small business person. And on a very, now that today there's a lot of light, no, I saw a lot of billions being flashed by the financial institutions that are supposed to be deployed towards building black business. I'm saying to you, if that was the case, we would have seen the shift. We wouldn't be sitting here pleading for radical socio-economic empowerment if indeed that money was deployed and we could feel and touch it.
George. Dr. Beloy, you used 8.5 minutes. We're
That's
going
fine.
To give you 2 minutes for interruption, but that does mean your colleagues only have 9 minutes left between them.
Yes, Chairperson, because of that, we are going to appeal with you that we come back here on the 22nd to speak about the next section, because I understand you have some space, but try and put us in the morning. We are also coming to talk about the amendments of the FICA bill that you promised us that we can bring them here because they were not part of the other one. So we promise we'll come with all those things that we could, you could not, we could not speak about in the public hearing, and we'll give that presentation. Thank you very much.
But we'll pass the FICA bill. Why should we meet to run around forever? We don't want to have meaningless discussions. They were busy.
We don't want to give them another minute, please.
No, well,
Chair.
Everybody was given 15 minutes, and we have to be fair.
Yeah,
but we will, I think, just explain to the Trade and Industry Committee. Here, when we meant any other related issues, we mean anything. Including
yeah.
your concerns about the FICA bill, put it in writing again. But you can't demand another 15 minutes. That would be unfair.
Okay.
Okay.
Check
but
in.
One of your structures can do it. I mean, you can find a front structure. You know how you operate. Right. So, I mean, really. But you can't come to BBC again. It's out.
Chair.
Now I have got 6 minutes left.
No, but it can be 6 minutes. I haven't started.
Since you started, you only had 16 minutes, and
okay.
we've given you an extra 2 and now an extra 1. Please.
Mine is literally to give a solution in terms of what could be done to achieve what the Minister of Finance announced during the budget speech, to say only 10% of the population of this country owns 90% of the economy of this country, which is a very sad statement. So I think it's important for me to give you that solution. So, and I want to give you just a quick quote on the from the quarterly labor force survey that says the 2017-18 budget was an opportunity for the government to concentrate on addressing South Africa's radical economic transformation to deal with the youth aged 15 to 34 who remain vulnerable in the labor market with unemployment rate of at least 37.1%, which is 10.6 percent points above the national average. So that's quite worrying. Now, what do we need to do? And we take an uncompromising position in this regard. Our achievement of radical economic transformation can only be done as follows. One, all new insurance licenses must have a minimum black ownership of 51%. That's our approach. The second, there must be set aside.
Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt. Can you be a little bit slow? I know he's got 9 minutes. I want to capture some of the points, because suggestions.
Okay.
Oh, okay. All right.
There must be set aside of up to 35% for black entrepreneurs as a condition of licensing. I don't know if it's understood. Third, at least a minimum of 30% of financial services companies should, by no default, be allocated to black asset managers to manage as part of black enterprise development. Because the problem that we have is all black asset managers are only dependent on one client, which is PIC, which is a problem. There's no way you can grow those businesses if they're only dependent on PIC. And we can't allow that to continue. We must set up a financial sector commission to monitor the progress and performance of this sector, because it needs a special attention. It's in the hub of transforming this country. And if we don't do that, I recall when I was an ESCO member of APSA Capital, which was many years ago, and I headed the diversity committee of the bank. The problem is the shift has not moved. People come and go, come and go. There's no internal transformation. And I think it's important to have a special monitoring process. The skills development and progression of black professionals to deregionalize the sector is one specific key area that needs to be given a focus. We want to ensure that the BE ownership must be a JSE listed compliance. And we have to make sure we regulate that, so that when companies report on the stock exchange, we want to know the truth of this compliance on the JSE. The problem of this BE rating that a black person has to justify themselves, how black they are, it's unheard of. That I'm a black person, I have to justify how black I am. So that a white-owned company has a higher level than a black-owned company. 100% black-owned company doesn't make sense. So that's a challenge we have to deal with. And we say there must be reviewed in totality, because there's a lot of corruption that is happening within the BE rating agencies. From the procurement point of view, we say 51%, just as a start on the full procurement expenditure of government, must be set aside for black ownership. And that must be expanded to the financial services industry, because it's in the core of highest expenditure of procurement that sits there. We obviously have never been favored the triple PFA, which the bank also has benefited quite a lot. So if it's implemented from the national treasury, it must be repealed, because it's a 90-10 principle. If you are a small financial services industry against a larger bank, there's no way you can win against them. So we say it must be repealed in totality, and the procurement bill must be fast-tracked in order to deal with that. And we have to review the current, procurement regulations, as it still allow financial services businesses to benefit, because the 30%, as it was mentioned, that it benefits the 30% total expenditure of government on the subcontracting basis will be spent on black business. It's not the truth. We were quite disappointed that we haven't had any presentation from the financial services industry, that even though we announced in terms of the growth of the economy, the black industrialization program, nothing was discussed on what value the financial services role is going to be. And we are demanding that at least a minimum of 30 billion rand to be made available for the black industrialist program, not only for government, but in partnership with the financial services industry. The new banking licenses, we have already made this submission. We said, what is wrong with the regulator to say the minimum 51% of the new licenses must be black-owned? I'm not going to talk about whether the capital adequacy and others are so critical. Those are commercial aspects that could be discussed. But as a matter of principle, that's what we want, as a minimum compliance. Payment of suppliers across the board has always been a problem of government, while we have a very conventional method and innovative method of funding these suppliers. And we are saying this 30-day payment is another form of funding for the small business, and it must be enforced. The once empowered, always empowered, which the financial services have argued again, we are totally against that. And we say the financial services must refrain from that once empowered, always empowered. It doesn't help with the transformation. This is not about compliance. It's not about compliance. It's about doing the right thing. That's the ready day. It has been mentioned the dividend withholding tax, the reliance of the B parties in doing transaction, because empowerment is not only at the lower level, it's even transforming the JSC listed companies, is that we rely on these dividends to refinance our debt. And we say there must be an exception on the transaction.
Second.
And surely, yes, it's correct that how much has been, the value has been accrued on those transactions. And we, which is very important, we say, if you really want to build the economy of the country, there is no way you can have 3 billion, 4 billion for the entire 9 provinces to fund the SMEs. And this is not the responsibility of only government. This is the responsibility of all the financial services sector. And what does it take to put a 50 billion rand joint fund between the financial services sector and the government? Thank you.
Thank you very much. We did, in fact, give you 22 minutes to compensate, so we can't do that for everyone. We'd be leaving at midnight. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Right. Then if we may proceed to the Association of Black Securities and Investment Professionals, APSA. I see the APSA laptop there loud as light. So perhaps you can just come across. And I'm hoping that the Black Insurance Advisors Council, Volcano Accountants, etc., please have your presentations ready. This won't be the first time you've made a presentation to a group of people. We can't waste time. So can we please start immediately? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members. The APSIC team consists of the Deputy President, Delphine Govender, seated on my left, the founding president of APSIC back in 1995, Mr. Muke Mohatse, seated right there, and our chief negotiator and member of the Western Cape branch of APSIC, Asif Mohammed. Thank you very much for the opportunity to present to this esteemed committee. APSIC is an association in its 22nd year of existence. Over the past 22 years, we have been unrelenting in advocating and negotiating for change, transformation, and inclusion in the financial services sector. APSIC's membership includes corporates, black firms, and professionals within the sector, as well as students pursuing studies that will result in them working in the sector. APSIC is an affiliate member of the Black Business Council, where its responsibility is to lead on matters pertaining to the financial services sector. We've made our submission to contribute to a turning point in the landscape of the sector. We at APSIC envision a transformed, fully inclusive, ethically run financial sector that equitably represents black professionals and black businesses to enable sustainable growth for the sector and the country at large. South Africa has a world-class financial sector that can be further enhanced to benefit a wide range of stakeholders in the economy. The sector has grown over the past years. However, growth has not been shared equitably by all who breathe life to the sector. It has also undergone difficulties from time to time, but has remained resilient and responsive to challenges faced by the economy. Despite its efforts, the sector has not been perfect and could actually have done more for South Africa. For example, funding institutions...
So sorry, but what are you using on the overhead just to cover?
No. We
are you coming up with a few slides?
Yes.
Thanks.
Where was that? For example, funding institutions could have done much more to enable black businesses to access finance on favorable terms. In the investment management subsector, asset owners, asset consultants, and retirement fund trustees are aware that less than 5% of assets under management are managed by black asset managers. As corporate citizens, they could have done more to break down high concentration in the subsector and give opportunities to black firms. In the stockbroking subsector, the dealing rooms of asset managers could have ensured that the brokerage commissions of only 1.6% attributable to black stockbrokers are significantly increased. Merged entities could have done much more, particularly on the ownership and management control elements of the FSC scorecard. We must change the face of the financial services sector to reflect fully a normal, equal, and inclusive society. Another example is that quite recently, the banking subsector committed some market conduct errors that have strengthened the need for regulation. And could that be the Twin Peaks bill? While these are some of the sector's imperfections, not all is gloom and doom. It is important that successes produced by the sector be highlighted, preserved, and promoted, and failures pointed out and corrected. APSIC's position on transformation is that the economy and wealth distribution in South Africa should ultimately reflect the demographics of the population and by implication reflect a normal and equal society. To us, transformation is not just about attaining the highest level of BEE rating. It must be both qualitative and quantitative. It's about systematically putting an equitable share of the economy and wealth in the hands of the majority, that is black people. Transformation must be underpinned by growth and inclusiveness. Black businesses and black professionals must be an inherent part of the economic equation. Large business and small business must work together and support each other to grow. The resulting growth must be shared equitably. Now I will speak about the monopolies in the sector. The request for public submissions requested for comment on the high level of monopoly in the financial sector. Strictly speaking, in the economic sense, the term monopoly embodies the concept where there is only one producer or seller of a product or service with control over price and quantity. However, within the context of the current discussion in relation to the transformation of the South African financial sector, APSIC believes that the issue, the central issue at play, is that of market structure. The structure of a market with monopoly being one type of such a structure is determined by the nature and degree of competition and market concentration. I will now speak briefly on market concentration, and it's depicted on the slide. Now, in the asset management sector, for example, the measure of the market is assets under management. We have about 9 trillion assets under management, 120 is the number of participants in the sector. There is a 70% concentration to the 10% to the 10 top asset managers, and none of them are black. And black firms share less than 5% of the market. In the stockbroking sector, the total value traded on the JSE is about 12 trillion rands. There are 55 players. There is also market concentration, which is at the top 10, which are all white firms. The black stock brokers only have a 1.6% share of brokerage commission. I can say more, but I choose to skip the slide so that I can make some ground, because time is limited. It's been quite difficult to get the data, I must say. We do need a reliable and credible central repository for such data. Our conclusion on the matter of market structure is that there is a high level of concentration. This does not augur well for black players, as it renders them unable to compete. On the issue of deracialization, we have submitted case studies of the asset management and stockbroking subsectors to illustrate the low degree and slow pace of deracialization. The case studies highlighted the kind of growth trajectory that is required for deracializing the financial services sector to effectively create a stable, efficient, and competitive market. The assumption of our submission is that the financial services sector is a public good, and as it is foundational to social development and economic growth, and that exclusion from participating in the sector is unjust. In terms of progress in implementing the FSC, as a result of the work that APSIP has done since 2003, alongside trade associations, labor, community, government, and other stakeholders in the FSC Council, we have made some strides and some progress. However, much more remains to be done. The opportune time to accelerate progress cannot be better than now. APSIP believes that while transformation of the sector has been slow, some progress has been recorded, and much more can and must still be done, and at a faster pace. Legislative and regulatory support are key to advancing transformation, as is a collaborative, supportive, and inclusive effort by both large, established, and small emerging players. Transformation must be mass-based and characterized by mass access to financial services and opportunities instead of only capital interest. We trust that measured entities will embrace and implement the new FSC code speedily. As APSIP, we are looking forward to monitoring and evaluating their transformation performance at the FSC Council, where we sit. We also look forward to yet another alignment process with generic codes. We have a few recommendations, Chairperson, that we have tabled in our submission. I will go through some of them. We need compulsory disclosure to be made by key market participants in each financial subsector to a certain market share at a subsector level. APSIP recommends that a form of compulsory disclosure is required for all participants in financial subsectors in order to determine the stage of the market structure and whether transformation is meaningfully occurring. This should be factored at a subsector level with an annual disclosure made publicly. Without the data, measuring the pace of transformation is exceedingly difficult and masked. The second recommendation, annualized statistics should be maintained by every regulating authority of every registered firm within a relevant subsector, including the market share of the firm. Three, target concentration ratios must be set by policymakers to reflect more competitive market structure, with targeted black firm participation at a subsector level and with specific targeted dates. Four, expand the FSC to include process and outcome indicators. Inclusive growth relates to both process and outcomes. Expand the FSC to include variables that track. Okay. Five, develop inclusive growth paths for each subsector. Six, introduce sanctions for non-compliance with BBB scorecard. Seven, ensure effective monitoring. Eight, regulatory compliance should be matched with support to new entrants. Nine, allocate resources to deregionalize the sector. Current government funding schemes for black startups are skewed towards other sectors, namely construction, wholesale, mining, and manufacturing. A dedicated fund for new entrants into the financial services sector should be established. 10. Black women's participation in the financial services sector should be placed high on the agenda. 11. FSC Council's survey participation rate must be sharply improved. 12. FSC Council should embark on an intensive dissemination campaign of the current transformation review report with the intention to speed up implementation of transformation plans. 13. In-depth studies are required on the characteristics of subsectors. 14. Future FSC transformation review reports must provide overall ranking of subsectors and indicators within an element. And the last one, to encourage BBBE as opposed to narrow BEE, the FSC Council should make inclusion of mandated investments mandatory. A lower graduated weighting for ownership should be given if the fund or asset manager has a low BBBE score. We have made more recommendations, Chairperson, and the Chair and honourable members are welcome to go to our submission. Thank you very much.
Right on target, 15 minutes. Thank you. I can see that you are actually right. Thank you very much, and we would like the expanded recommendations. Can we then move to the Black Insurance Advisors Council? The Black Insurers Advisors Council. Hello? Right, they're not here, too. Great, all right. That saved us a bit of time. Bacana Accountants Incorporated. Also gone AWOL or whatever. Right, well then, discussion.
We checked with the committee secretary yesterday. It's very unfortunate, right, that people told us they come in because if you can't come, we can swap around with the 26. It's really unfair. And since they haven't told us not coming in, unless they give us a legitimate reason, I don't think we should include them. It's really wasting other people's time. So now, Stella Rasataba, you're going to have 40 minutes if you want. I want to ask you a frank question, Stella, knowing you were or are a comrade. You didn't arrange this so that you could get an extra 30 minutes, did you? Okay, I take your word for it. Fine, thank you.
Okay, I think we've agreed that this goes straight into the discussion, but quite clearly you would have a bit more time to spend in responding. Had we known this earlier, we would have been able to give you a bit more time. Let's look at the committee, though. We have, we have the Honourable Pacoli Tobias there, Honourable Williams, Honourable, always remember your first name and never the other mania. And then, I can see Honourable Mabi, but I just can't, I only know the Honourable Shivambu very well. EFF, didn't get the name, all right, okay. And then the Honourable Mabi, is that right? Well, let's start.
Thank you, Chair. Is it not me? Yes, Chair. Before I ask...
Chair, sorry, I'm looking after the Honourable Mabi.
No.
Apologize?
I raised my hand after Honourable Mabi.
Yes, you probably did. I was just trying to extract a name. It's a bit more difficult than Dana.
Oh,
all right. Thank you, the Honourable Shivambu. After Honourable Mabi, let's not have a debate. Right.
Why do you allow them to play? Thank you, Chair. Before I ask my question, I want to make an anecdote. In my previous life, I engaged banks at one point to say, in fact, I challenged banks in a statement to say banks are failing to invest in small business development. And I was approached by the bank, who at the time seemed willing to participate. And what I was told up front in my face was that as the banks were prepared to put a rent, if government is prepared to put a rent, but government should be prepared to take a bigger risk because we're a business. And I had to indulge that statement. I had to internalize that statement and to understand what it means. And sometimes when I listen to presentations, I wonder whether whilst we want to deal with the most important issue of transformation, we should also remember that in South Africa, we allow business to be able to be profitable, to compete, and not remove them. So that's one thing I wanted to say. Second, excuse you.
But don't allow yourself to be derailed.
No, I can't be derailed by this young man. Not at all. Chair, he's very bored. Let me go to my first question. It's based on what has been said by the BBC about the financial injection of 50 billion. And I'm going to be frank. To me, we need to have a discussion between the private sector and government for us to be able to raise this fund. It's not an issue that we'll make in a statement here in this hearing. We need to have the creativity to engage one another and say, look, here is an agenda. This is how much we'll need. Let's both raise those funds. And if those engagements doesn't take place at the level of government in the financial sector, it will just be words that has been uttered in a statement. So I remember that through Agisa, government used to say to the banking.
Chair,
but there's more time this time around. There's two presentations that
you've had. You've had 2.5 minutes. That's what I'm just giving you three.
Okay. Let me try to go fast, Chair. Let me leave that point and go to the next point.
I want us to speak about the 51% of the licensing that needs to be provided. Shouldn't we be saying that we need to have a phase-in approach so that as and when the licensing approach is phased in, we don't just look at it from an issue of addressing inclusion, but look at the capacity and the sustainability of doing that. So I want these recommendations to be succinct and be sustainable in terms of implementation, so that they shouldn't just be good on books. And I'm looking at Silva, I don't see him. That, yes, that when we do that, we do it through a phased-in approach and make sure that there is that gel in terms of implementation of what we want to achieve. Secondly, we need to take cognizance of the fact that we've got limited resources of government. That's a fact. It's not an issue that we need to be debating. When we speak about where we're going to get that resources, do we think that IDCs carry the capacity of a financial institution to be able to give you a projection of billions? No. No, it doesn't. It needs to have, it means that our treasury to start will have to mobilize funds. And you say dividend tax, people say no. And you say exclusion from us. So I don't even know where we're going to mobilize this fund. But it's an issue that we must come back, sit together, and find a way of getting that money that we can be able to put in place. And,
right.
And I hope, so, I thought Solly was going to make that proposal from this.
Well, we'll be giving everyone 3.5 minutes, right? Honourable Williams.
Thank you, Chairperson. The presenters, the Black Business Council and the ABSIP, in my opinion, are completely, absolutely right. We as government must compel transformation within this financial sector. We cannot just go round and round and round and leave this issue for our children to deal with. But it mustn't just be transformation from white rich people to black rich people. It must be inclusive transformation, so it must be everybody must benefit from this. If we had begun transformation in 2000, we'd be nearly totally transformed by now. And as government, I think that we've waited long enough for this voluntary transformation within the financial sector. And I think that we should start looking at compelling them to transform. Because today we had all these happy thought messages from the banking sector, but they completely ignored what has just been told to us now by Black Business Council and the ABSIP. And it seems to me, it seems the banks have also left today. They're not here in front of us anymore. So I think that as this committee, and I'm going to suggest it in trade and industry, that we start looking at mechanisms to compel the sector to start transforming properly, because it's absolutely ridiculous what's happening here, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Williams. Chairperson.
As I understand it, all the banks are here in some form or another. What the CEOs explained, and one of them is Mr. Chabalala, so to be fair, every bank is here. The arrangement with them was that they must stay till the end of the hearing, and to be fair, they're all here, and the Banking Association is here. But you can't expect them to have the whole phalanx of people here.
Right. Right. It doesn't preclude second rounds, as you probably know. Right. Honourable Mania?
Mania. Thank you. Chair, when it comes to the Black Business Council, I mean, the credibility of the presentation hinges on the credibility of the presenter. And so my question to Dr. Denise Beloy is it true that you have a fake PhD, that you were fired as a director of ABSA, and that you were involved in one of the biggest financial scandals?
We're not going to allow it
that David all the time in peace on people's integrity.
Let's not allow this to deteriorate into a circus. Thank you. And not have dialogue. Would you continue, Honourable Mania?
I've asked my question. Thank you.
Thank you. Then can we move on to the next person? And it's the Honourable Dlamini. Thank you.
No, thanks, Chairperson. BBC. Yeah, I think now.
I'm just asking you, Honourable Chair, not to have a private dialogue with other bodies. Now put your hand down, please, Honourable Member.
Can I ask you a question, Chair?
No, there is someone on the floor, and you know. Honourable Dlamini.
Okay, no, thanks, Chair. No, BBC, I think now you are taking shape. Because on things that you are raising, we are agreeing and look like you are listening to us when we speak. But just three quick issues. On the issue of the procurement, we agree, but don't you think that because the issue of procurement, when you look at the current system now, we've got a lot of middlemen, and that is the procurement that we're talking about. But when we don't talk of massive industrialization, we talk to the issues of land, by the way, that we need to get that land. That's when you're going to have the real value. Because this procurement is just middlemen that are busy procuring from the state. And then secondly, on the issue of 30-day payment, I think you are just being lazy. You are business. You are the one who's supposed to be creative. Just neighboring countries such as Zambia, they've gone beyond the issue of 30-day payment. They've got what you call payment guarantee facilities, that when they do business with the state, they provide payment guarantee facilities. Because if you got that, then it deals with the issue of blackmail and corruption that happens within that space of 30 days payment, when suppliers are looking for their payment and then they're being blackmailed by officials. So I'm challenging, I'm sending that back to you, that go and investigate that thoroughly, because it's just, you can't just accept that. It's not the alpha and the omega. But finally, that's what I'm saying. We agree with everything that you are saying. Just do us a favor now. Stay away from the Guptas and those Gupta zombies and everything, so that we can understand you and be able to support you. Because now when you've got those people within you and we don't know who's speaking, so just do that, otherwise we are coming right now.
Thank you, Honourable Dlamini. Honourable Shivambu.
Thank you, Chair. I think we should also encourage the BBC to meet with APSIC more frequently, because despite the correctness of the BBC's approach on some of the issues, APSIP's qualitative analysis is quite impressive and must be mentioned. But one of the substantial issues that they deal with, you just have to align your targets in terms of what do you want to be legislated as black ownership. I think that we can talk about that. But also I think we need to move towards the stage, Chair, of defining the content of black ownership. So that it's not just elite empowerment only. There must be a different discourse that should happen. And I think we must also explore the possibility of amending the financial market.
Shivambu, can we please respect the speaker on the floor? Please. Right, Honourable Shivambu.
There are things that we must explore, the possibilities of what can we do with the Financial Market Act that establishes stock exchanges. The Minister of Finance said that there's two new stock exchanges that have been approved for existence in South Africa, and a provisional license for the post banks. In terms of the stock markets, I think that we could possibly have an influence over their listing requirements, that in South Africa, which is defined by historical inequalities and legislated exclusion of the black majority, perhaps it will be responsible to have a certain degree of black participation in all listed corporations. And that can be factored in the Financial Markets Act in terms of what is required. I think those are some of the detailed issues that can be looked into. And Commissioner Marshall Dlamini is correct that manage your politics properly and not do what we're trying to do, trying to do unconstitutional things like wanting to have to discuss speaker bill when it has passed away. Stay on your rail and on issues of principle and not try to take us to wrong directions, because we're not here for that. We want to not take you serious, like we undermined you when we came with the figure proposals that were displayed. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Dlamini. you, Honourable Shivambu, Honourable Mabe.
Thanks, Chair. Just to also commend the BBC, I think they are bringing forward quite progressive submissions, especially as it relates to how we must deal with the insurance space, including how we should be looking at the issue of increasing black ownership in that space. I think that is quite critical. But more important is to begin to have these different institutions working together, because it looks like you are one in terms of the transformation agenda. What the Actuaries Association and what APSIP are talking about and what the Black Business Council are talking about seems to be one, especially as it relates to the whole notion of radical economic transformation and how you deal with the transformation agenda. But the other important thing, Chair, which needs to be looked at is the whole thing of the BEE quota. Actually, now it has even gone further, where companies are forced to do self-regulation on BEE, where they sign affidavit. You know, so you could just imagine, and you can have a company that is unscrupulous in a way, and they place themselves where they are a level one BEE company. And if no one really questioned that, during a bidding process, such an entity could be looked at differently. You know, they would be able to score on those points, because unfortunately, our own supply chain regime is built around those things, to look at the price, to look at the BEE and all of that. Maybe we just need to strengthen our own regulations to make sure that they are not abused. But more importantly, I mean, earlier in the day when we were listening to the banks and all of that, some of the things that were coming up, and maybe it's an advantage that some of these organizations must take advantage, maybe something that some of these organizations must take advantage of, the ownership of the banks. I mean, Barclays, for instance, I mean, it was in APSA, it was clear that there is something in there for the taking. So the entities that are, the companies that are presenting, including organizations presenting to us here, seem to have the necessary stature and standing to begin participating in that space. I mean, when the window is open, thereafter, you need to be putting in a leg there. Otherwise, we're going to come back here again and we'll still be sitting at 6% or even lower. Because the problem with some of Africans is when they've invested in companies, once they start seeing some liquid, they cash out. You know, so it's important that when those things are open, they begin participating in those. And again, maybe as a rider, is that we are again taking this feedback to fit into our policy document going into the policy conference in June, because the notion of radical economic transformation must find expression as a result of the ANC when we go to the 54th National Congress this year, Chairperson Karim. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Mardi. We are well ahead on time due to two presenters not coming forward.
Maybe I just wanted to say it's early days yet in the process that's unfolding, the new phase that began this morning. Now, you know, I like to say, Jacello, that, you know, I think the meeting agrees. We don't have to sit here till 7:15, obviously. There's no need for that. We can be over by 6:30, in my view, even earlier. But what we could do, since the banks are here, Basa is here, you might want to, each of you, maybe starting with Basa, take a few minutes, if you care to at this stage, to respond to some of the issues. Because at the end of the day, there has to be negotiation between government and yourself and other stakeholders, new entrants or emerging or aspirant new entrants, and parliament, because there might be legislative and other amendments that have to be made. So what I'm saying is, you know, what do you think, co-chair? What do members feel? We give you a few minutes to respond. Recognizing that we've still got a second day of sittings and a third, and possibly we have to a fourth. But that's a proposal. You can take it forward if you want. Yeah. Yeah, and then maybe we can. Yeah. But Sipisa wants to come in.
Sipisa.
Chair, just a process suggestion. I think we've got two more presentations to listen to. Why don't we listen to those two? Before then, you can allow the bench to come in so that they can make their responses after that.
Yes, but we are allowing the presenters who've just been before us to respond. Thank you very much. And just before you do, I must say I was impressed that you're taking into account the Black Industrialist Development Program and also making certain proposals. Thank you. First, BBC.
Yes, I'll start with a non... No, I'm not going to go to the gutter like him. You know, I will not descend to the gutter. Because at the end of the day, if he has information, he can't come here with snippets. I can get to the gutter and tell my mayor that I will not allow somebody who is a product of apartheid to tell me that he is
No.
He said you didn't stop him.
You did not stop him.
No, you
did. Dr. Malloy, turn the mic off.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. What was the interruption?
Sorry,
I didn't see who it was even. Honourable Shibambu?
That's right.
See your hand. Whose hand about that?
No, yes. I think that the president of the BBC must not shout at members of parliament. Whatever is the case, I think the composure would be necessary that let's deal with the issues and then we can get space outside. They can shout at each other there after the meeting. I think the composure is necessary, the temperament is necessary in terms of how we deal with each other moving forward as well. So let us not shout at each other.
And also, no, thank you, Honourable Munir. Honourable Munir, you are talking while I'm on the floor, please. Dr. Malloy, I think it would be very pertinent for us all to just refrain from, you know, perhaps raising our voices in the manner that if you've raised yours, and to address us appropriately. Thank you. Everyone here is a member of Parliament. Thank you.
Okay. No, I just believe that we come here, Chair, being respectful. And if he has facts that he wants to put on the table, then he has to tell me who charged me, who find me guilty, who put me in prison. You understand? For him to come and throw that, and he did that when we were not there, and he was grandstanding in Parliament. I don't think that is correct. And by the way, my credibility is not for him. It is for the people who elected me, just as I might doubt his credibility as to the people who elected him, but it is here nor there.
Just address the substantive issues.
Yes, and then I go to the substantive issues because this is not, it's no longer important and relevant to me what is just raised. I'll go to the issue of what was raised by Honorable Shibambu and Honorable Dlamini. Indeed, the issue of pay of late payments bedevil us, and I think we'll take the challenge. And the other thing that I think is important is that we will engage with the bank to come up with your suggestion that we sit down and chair, as you suggested as well. We sit down with the bank and try to form that partnership that will enable us to work out a program. I think there are processes and programs in place
that have to do with some money that has been set aside. And I think if we all put our heads together and ensure that it's not numbers that are bandied around, 30 billion a year, 75 billion there, make sure that it actually goes back and it works for the people who we lead. And I think that will work very, very well, but we'll take your advice on that one. And Honorable Shambo, George?
Continue.
Okay, let me respond on the issue of the 51% banking license. I must tell you that, as I mentioned on my presentation, that the issue of compliance, the issue of capital adequacy, is an issue of partnership. By the way, by law, 51% black ownership means it's anything from 51% and above. So you could still have a partner who is a white partner, who has the capability, who has the skills, and you can partner with very capable black individuals. So I don't see any reason why, because we have always said we want to see a black-owned bank. It cannot be that difficult to issue that license, because today we are dominated by white banks. That's the fact of the matter. So that's the answer. I'm not sure what you were asking on the dividend tax, but I think the issue that I wanted to explain is exactly what I've explained. To say it's a critical issue. It could have been an oversight from National Treasury and the Parliament at the time when the budgets were done. But it's so critical for black entrepreneurs who are financing this transaction, because we rely on the dividends to repay the transactions. And that's really the challenging situation. Then it means you are either the tenure of the transaction is going to be longer, or there won't be any other BE transactions to be done because they're not fundable. And that's really the challenge. So the Gupta issue, I think, is critical for me to deal with. It's a Secretary General of BBC. It will be it's a serious fallacy for people who don't understand the structure of BBC to think that we are controlled by the Guptas. We have an associate with the Guptas. I would like to challenge anybody who can look at any of our documents and tell me where the power of the Gupta comes into our organization. BBC is led by office bearers who are as sophisticated, as capable, as smart to be led and be controlled by one group of people outside. We represent 51 organizations that are led by presidents that make decisions as a national, collective national council. There's no individual that sits and make a decision on behalf of BBC. Our mandate is very simple, is to advance black people, black business in the mainstream of the economy. So for somebody to come and say, we are the Guptas, I think that's a lack of misunderstanding. I think that must be clarified and it must stop. Because we have even gone publicly to say, we are not in alliance with Guptas. We will not be in alliance with Guptas. That's a fact. So I think it's clarified.
Yeah, mine is very simple. We wouldn't like this interaction to portray the Black Business Council as an errant child. We are talking to the banks. Yeah, we are talking to the banks. We just had a meeting with Barclays on Friday. Yesterday, before we came here, we sat in technical teams with National Treasury, identified some of these things we are bringing here to say, how can we resolve them? Will you support us if we want this legislation? So what we are trying to do, we talk to Floyd. We talk to the study group of the ANC. We haven't got a meeting yet with the GA, and we'd love to have it. Because it's only when South Africans come together that we are going to be able to have radical economic transformation, and we can all live together ever after. Thank you.
Very much. And then from the other presenters who were here, let's see who it was. the Association of Black Securities and Investment Professionals. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. There weren't specific questions levelled at us, but perhaps just some comments in relation to the Honourable Members Shivambu and Jlamini, who alluded to the fact that ATSIP and the BBC should speak more. We actually do engage, and as we mentioned in our presentation, we are one of the member firms, and we, in the same way that the BBC advances the opportunity set for black people and black business and the economy at large, ATSIP is focused on the financial sector specifically. It doesn't necessarily mean we would always necessarily have a meeting of minds on every single thing, as you saw with the FICA Amendment Bill recently, which ATSIP supported. The comment that we tried to bring forward, and thank you for the acknowledgement on the data which we tried to include in our submission, which I wanted to point out is unbelievably difficult to extract and obtain from all the subsector and market participants. And this is what is really making it extremely hard to measure the pace of transformation, particularly in terms of the concentration within the subsectors. While the barriers to entry might be purportedly low, in fact, the issues are the barriers to scale for black business, and particularly to black professionals. So you can have, for example, an asset management subsector with 120 players and 42 majority black-owned business, but they can't get to scale because those 42 businesses represent a third of the sector, but only less than 5% of the actual assets in the sector. So one of the ways we have put forward that I'd just like to reiterate, and I think our colleague from the actuaries, Lahotla, also mentioned it, was one of the ways to compel this data is to also use the financial services sector charter to compel a far higher rate of participation in obtaining the data. This is still self-regulated and it's still voluntary, and the level of financial services sector charter participation and disclosure is extremely low, as is the sector itself in terms of reports, quite outdated in terms of when the last publicly available report has been released. I think it's 2012 or 2013 that was the last one, and we're now in 2017. So this is a big obstruction to, as a professional body, trying to measure this pace. And for this committee, we would really say one of the things we would take back to the Financial Services Sector Charter was to really compel this disclosure. It is something that happens globally. In the US, they call it congressional accountability, and that was one of the main tools that was used to really shift the sector forward in terms of transforming. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think at this point then, we can move on, Chair. All right. Yourself then, yes, thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity, Chairperson. You know, Chairperson, in 1992, Mam Sisulu made a workshop for the Women League and called parliamentarians from Poland, from other Canada, and they warned us that when you go to Parliament, you must watch out for male chauvinists who will always find derogative remarks for women. And I'm not going to betray Mam Sisulu when she's gone. And here, this shadow minister of finance in this parliament must be impeached and thrown out of parliament. You have broken the constitution. Yes, the affirmative action principle, where do you put it? You are very, very disrespectful to the public. This is a parliament's people, and we cannot have a disrespectful member of parliament. You're not worthy of the honor. Thank you.
Thank you. That was, am I right, the Honourable Shorpe Satorley? Right. Thank you. What
just
I'd like to do.
Asking the hard questions.
Yeah. What I'd like to do now is to move on to first source money. Where is it, first source money? Are you here?
Yes.
Thank you. Do you have a presentation? Because no one seems to have a copy. Your presentation, where is it? Well, we need at least one at the table. We have you not just got one for us at the table here? Well, just hold on. We're going to have to. I would have hoped that could have been done earlier. Can you go and get a stick with me? Mr. Service de Kock here. Where is Service de Kock? Can you come across here, please? Have you got a presentation? Have you got a presentation? And I'm glad you know the state so that we might share this with other
people and understand what you're not saying to them. Are you part of
the
I'm just going to make a brief point on the speech about the time. I'm just going to make a point about
you can go ahead, we've got a hard copy.
We're going to deal with Mr. de Kock first, so that it will enable First Source Money to access the stick so that we can get a copy. Right. Mr. de Kock? I want to make sure we can all see that. I'm sure everyone does have a copy, am I correct? Standing Committee on Finance, it's the Global Compass Roadmap, is a roadmap. Right. And the First Source Money, where are you? Yes, borrow a stick. And then, Mr. Medema, just sort that out.
So I'm going to make a presentation.
Just got a little admin problem here, technology problem, which I understand will be sorted out pretty soon. I know it's been a very long day and we're facing a graveyard shift, but this is a very important set of public hearings and engagement with the private sector. Has everyone got a copy? Right. Are we all set to go? Right. On that note, perhaps we can all take a seat. Right. Mr. de Kock.
Mrs. Chair, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here today. You will see I'm one of those no-brand companies or individuals, so you must or maybe ask, so what are you doing here? What I can say is that I'm a normally taxpayer from Durbanville, and I don't represent anyone, So I represent the man in the street. But that being said, that I'm an ex-banker, and I call myself now an applied academic. So, and I also believe that why reinvent the wheel if there's international studies, international similar things that we can have a look at. But before that, and I think it's late in the day now, and it's a very serious place, this. I can see there's fights and there's emotions. Can I be a little bit more lighthearted? They say that there's two things in life that we prefer not to talk about. And the one is money or finance, and the other one is sex. And the question is, why those two? Because all of them is personal, it's private, there's normally a trust relationship, and it lets loose emotions. So that's why you get sometimes that people will never talk about money or finances. That's why I'm so glad that we are here and we spend the whole day just to talk about money and finances. Thank you very much for that. What my function is merely to say to you that, firstly, I find it very interesting since this morning where we alternatively talk about the financial sector transformation and also the economic sector transformation. So, according to me, that's two totally different aspects, but although they part of each other. So what I see is that there's not a common denominator, there's not common language when we talk about financial and financial sector and transformation. So I think that's one of the things that we must address. Secondly, I just want to give you some overview and an helicopter view of what I see is internationally currently also done with regards to financial sector transformation. The first thing is that you will see, and maybe I can just ask some of the people or all of the people here, that have they ever met or have they ever measured their own companies or their own organization against the 2030 Sustainable Development Goals from the United Nations? Because we are one of the G20 countries that has signed that, and that we are part of that Sustainable Development Goals. So my question is this something that we can learn from this? Because certainly I believe, and being very practical, I would challenge you to go, if it's a big bank, if it's a small organization, if it's a political party, just look at any one of those 17 and see what you can do and what you can achieve and how do you measure against those sustainable development goals. Because financial inclusion is one of those goals that runs right to, is being aligned through all 17 of them. And if the G20 countries have adopted this and they measure themselves on not only inclusion but various other goals, then it's certainly something that this committee and this members can actually have a look at. So the development goals are an ambitious plan of action for people, planet, and prosperity, the triple P. They are universal, applying to all nations and people seeking to tackle inequality and leave nobody behind. They are wide-ranging, including ending poverty and hunger, ensuring sustainable consumption and production, and promoting peaceful and inclusive societies. So if that's the overriding goals of this, then my question is, but is there not something that we can learn from the international studies that is already there, that was done and that we signed between 2013-2015, and the end goal is more or less 2030. If we go further, and I will not go into the details because it is in my presentation, But there's a purpose A, a purpose B, and you can also have a look there. They say the world has never before united by a set of global goals on poverty, inequality, injustice, and climate change. Not achieving these goals would be triggered with the biggest market failure of our times. Financial markets must play a vital role in increasing a sustainable future for all of us. Also in South Africa, I believe that we must do that. So what I've done is I've just picked at random, for instance, number one, and one of the goals there is no poverty. So my question is, does it apply to South Africa or not? And my answer is, yes, it does apply to South Africa. But how can we do that in a practical way? We say that innovate to develop new financial products, credit scoring methodologies, and I will just stop there for a second, and my question is, how do we credit score in South Africa? How do we credit score when someone doesn't have a physical address, that someone doesn't have, for instance, an ID number, that doesn't have an account, that doesn't have a record? This is the kind of stuff that we are sitting today and that we hear today, and I think that we can look at that. Operating models and distribution channels, including mobile banking, to advance financial inclusion, including banking for the 2.5 billion adults currently without a bank account, and micro insurance to increase social protection. That's worldwide. And we are part of that phenomenon. Number five, gender equality. And I'm so lucky I'm a man, but I also fight for the women. So they said one of the goals is that they set for us as South Africa as well is gender equality. And how can we do that? Very practical stuff. Design new savings, credit and insurance products and distribution models which enable women in high growth markets to establish and grow businesses in both urban and rural environments. And while I'm saying rural, in rural environments, my question is, I just wanted to ask for, there's groups of people, and you will see that my emphasis is going a little bit further on cooperative banking, but where is the members that has gone that far from Limpopo, or from the Lowveld, or even from other sides of the country? Are they here, or are they still here? I think they just left, but they were here coming especially today from rural areas to see what's happening with hope in their lives, to see how we can actually take financial services transformation and help them. Adapt credit processes and lending methods. That's just a brief there. Decent work and economic growth. That's another factor, number eight. Expand microfinance, savings, credit, and insurance for small business owners. Now the question is how? I don't know how. There's many ways that we can do that. And I'm sure if you just look at all the stakeholders here, then we can do that. Expand finance for the missing middle class. Small entrepreneurs graduating from microfinance, which are not yet able to access credit from the formal banking sector. Provide target internships for young people from disadvantaged backgrounds in order to promote social mobility whilst also enhancing company performance through increased workforce diversity. So what we can say, I can say about my organization, I'm a stakeholder, we are already doing this, but can you tick off your number eight goal and say, my organization, do that, my political party, do that. Because we are all part of this very, very important transformation process. Why is it so important that we talk about this? We talk about this whole day, not about organizations, not about charters. We talk about people. So take the people and their emotions and their money personalities, take them out of financial inclusion and transformation. What is left? Machines, and maybe data, and maybe an empty parliament. Because we must transform. My question is from what to what. But we must always remember that there's people involved. when you do these transformation and you do these change processes. Then reducing inequalities, advise high net worth clients through banks' family offices that on the very extreme high end on investment and strategic philanthropy to advance sustainable development, expand use of new technologies such as satellite and spatial systems, big data and cloud computing to gain new insights which enhances risk and opportunity analysis. I've got here a brochure of South African companies, or a South African company, that, and one of the biggest challenges in South Africa is, how do I get internet access to the acacia tree in Limpopo or in the far north? How do I get reach to the sugar fields or sugarcane fields in KwaZulu-Natal or in the Eastern Cape where there is no internet? They can provide a satellite offering for us, whereby we can not only have access to internet, but also access to communication, of access to education and access to teaching that is so important. There's much more that we can talk, and there's not the opportunity for that. Then, number 17, partnerships for goals. The opportunities for shared value is strengthen the link between corporate and societal value creation and align the organization's value creation strategy to the sustainable development goals. If I look at sustainable development goals, two things that is important for me is that, and that's one is goals, and the second one is sustainable. And why is it that it's important? I believe that if we look at transformation and if we look at the change that we want to bring in, then it must be sustainable. And it must be sustainable for the people after us. Some of these is a little bit old like me, but some is very young. And we all want to leave a legacy, a financial inclusive legacy, or our own goal, and we must look at that. Then, what about the multiplier effect, if we can actually bring all these opportunities to people?
Yeah.
That,
right,
thank you, I will finish. And then, what I want to just discuss and briefly touch on is cooperative banking. We all talk about cooperative banking today in various forms. My question is that why is it not that successful currently in South Africa? Treasury has said this morning over the last 4 or 5 years they spent 40 million on cooperative banking. I think that's a drop in the ocean, but it's better than nothing. So why is it that we find that the stock float is there, the CFI, the cooperative financial institutions is there, and currently, just very briefly, that there's 32 of them, as we've heard. There's two cooperative banks that is registered with the South African Reserve Bank. They've got 30,000 members in the far-lying areas. They've got a small portfolio of 280 million in member deposits in all 9 provinces. Why can we not help them, maybe, to also pay out SASSA payments? So there's a list that I will send to you. But if I look, 30,000 members, and they only look after 3 people in their household, they actually change the lives of 100,000 or close between 90 and 100,000 people in all provinces. So what we see is that cooperative banking throughout the world, South Africa is virtually one of the smallest in Africa, but also one of the smallest in the whole world. My question is, if I say to you, do you know young women in business? Do you know KwaZulu Ladies, CFI? Do you know Barkenberg, CFI? But also, what is the latest trend? Do you know Medicorp, Western Cape? So what we find is that cooperative banking, suddenly there is now interest from professional people, and Medicorp is actually a cooperative in the Western Cape for medical people so that they can finance themselves. For me, cooperative banking
is actually, if you measure, they tick all the boxes of the development goals. And lastly, my question to you is then, what have we collectively as South Africans done to promote cooperative banking in South Africa? And I'm not saying I've got the answers, but there are some recommendations, and I will just be very quick if you don't mind. All right, you can have it there. So my last is in red there. That's a summary point. Is I would see that we arrange a formal platform for government, cooperative banking, and private sector role players to cooperate and strategize the above. So what can we do to recommend that, and how can we measure that? Thank you very much for the opportunity. Thank you. That as a normal man in the street.
Thank you very much. And then I'm hoping, thank you, Mr. De Kock. Thank you. I'm hoping, Chairperson, that what is this, the next person,
are we sorted,
Ms. Madalani?
Yeah, we can get started.
We can get started.
Sorry, Chair, can I raise something in fairness? It's the stakeholders here that must take primary responsibility, if not almost sole responsibility, for these. I don't think the committee needs to apologize. People come here at the last minute with presentations. In fact, between 11 on Friday and 12 o'clock, 13 of you suddenly applied and had to redo our program. So really, I think the committee sector has done very well. Those of you leaving, you must take all these documents with you. You've been demanding them. Now you've been demanding them. Please, fill your bags and take them with you. Read them, memorize them, summarize them, and put them in one-page summaries for us, right? So please, you have to take that. Can you put it right up front there, colleagues, so that when they go out, right? Sorry? Right, that one's circulating, and in the meanwhile, you know what you're going to say, right? So you can start.
I just wanted to add on, Chair, that the one point is that we are getting a lot of overheads, and you quite correctly have handed in the text, the longer text of 5 or 8 or 12 pages. But first of all, a lot of us can't see that clearly in front, and secondly, it would be very rude for me to have my back to everyone, or the chairperson, Karim. So please, when you bring a presentation you're going to speak to, do what has been done in Parliament certainly since 1994, and that is bring hard copies along or email it to the secretaries at least 3 days before. Thank you. And now, Mr. Inkosi, please continue.
Thanks, Chair. My presentation is going to take a slightly different approach from quite a number of them, but to seek to answer your co-chair's question of state banking and the Honourable Shivambo's intervention around the issues of credit allocation. It will also lean quite heavily to some of the matters outlined earlier by our colleagues from the BE. The question I think that we have to ask first and foremost is what exactly are we transforming? We're transforming the financial sector from where to where?
Members, please respect the speaker on the floor. I beg your pardon. Thank you.
Chair.
Yes, Honourable Dlamini.
We are interested in the presentation. Can we just get the introduction and ready form so that we can be able to follow it on?
Thanks very much. FESOS Money is a research, an economic research and advocacy firm. It's based in Pretoria. key interests are in the area of money, area of banking, and area of macroeconomics. So our interventions are going to, in a way, deal with issues of banking as a key component that is, in our view, responsible for much of the challenges that we face in our economy. If that's okay, I can proceed. Thanks very much, Honourable Member. But what you're asking here is, what exactly are we transforming? Are we transforming the entire financial sector? Are we transforming the banking? I suppose the answer is the entire financial sector. But from where to where and to achieve what? In our understanding, it's not necessarily the issue of BEE that we are dealing with. We're dealing with a combination of the BEE as well as the economy as a whole. Now, we find that the entire banking system has a demographic problem, obviously not transformed in terms of race, but also is inherently structural flawed, as a systemic challenges that the banking system has in this country. What then do we want to achieve? We want to achieve and put before this Honourable House a new institutional design for our financial sector, a design that's going to be to help us achieve sustainable, inclusive economic growth. But before I get into how to design our financial sector, or largely our banking sector, let's first understand what banking does. In my understanding, almost ever since this morning, we understand banks to be doing something but actually really it's not done by them. And therefore the policies that this House sets, the laws that we craft as a nation, are to a large extent based on what banks don't do. And hence someone was complaining that, look, we have so many laws that govern banks. It's because to a large extent we're actually putting laws that shouldn't have to be there. Banks, as we know them, they're not financial intermediaries at all. And that's the first thing that we know. I've seen my colleagues here, bankers, I've seen NetBank here, and CMEs here, and one of my colleagues that was working in government is also here, is at NetBank. We all know from at an early age where we think banks take money from Jimmy and lend it to James. Banks don't do that. And when you put up laws that talk that, you've already messed yourself up. But also, you've messed the entire economy. We say, therefore, that one of the reasons, in fact, key reasons, why we have this global financial crisis is because of misunderstanding that is there about what banks do. And all the regulations that are formed in the US, that are in the Basel Committee, and Basel in Switzerland, and so on, they're completely misplaced. Hence, we have this challenge. Recently, the Bank of England, which is the Reserve Bank of the UK, actually agreed with a position that we've held ourselves for quite a long while, that banks are not financial intermediaries. And that the stuff that we learn in books is actually wrong. But what are the banks then? And how should we regulate them as a house, as a country? But before we go to that, let's just quickly look at how economies grow. What do we mean when we say an economy has grown today? And yesterday it was, say, 5%, today 6%, or last year it was back on that. What do we mean? What we actually mean is that the economic transactions of, say, last year were lower than economic, are lower, or were lower than economic transactions of this year. Therefore, there is an economic growth of, say, 0.3%. But what are economic transactions? Economic transactions are money transactions. But then who creates this money and who allocates this money to the persons who get involved in economic transactions? That particular person is the one who becomes so critical
to any economy? And the answer, obviously, Chair, is that it is the banking system. Now, research here and everywhere else, we know that the creators of money in this country are the banks, and our commercial banks create 95% of the money system in this country. Only 5% of our money system is created by government. So many of us actually, when we say, well, I have money in the pocket, and we think it's money created by a reserve bank or government reserve bank. It's not. In advanced economies, 97% of money created there is created by commercial banks. Now, that person who creates money is the person who allocates that money. And who do they allocate that money to? In this country, we know, just like to say, they always allocate to those whom they think are credit worthy. And the entire black majority is almost defined as a risk. So the creators, therefore, and the allocators of money, which are the banks, are the persons that must, therefore, be charged with economic growth. How do we charge them with economic growth? Because the economy grows when economic transactions increase. But the allocators of money don't allocate money to persons who they think are risky. However, this government, of which has been part from President Mandela to President Zuma, continuously says that banks intermediate. And unless we move away from that, much of the time we'll be spending here, honorable members, will be almost a waste of time, because we are not going to be solving the problem that we should actually be solving. Right. Now, these creators of money, do they really understand the macroeconomic implications, we argue, of their decisions that they make? I was a former banker myself, certainly not. They don't understand. They just allocate the money the way they want, because they think this one is creditworthy, that one is not creditworthy. But does our government, does this parliament know that it has abrogated the responsibility of money creation to the private sector? Now, if this House has taken all its rights that is vested in it and given it over to the private sector, do we have to blame the private sector for allocating resources to only those it needs to allocate, and therefore refuse or deny the country of the opportunity to grow? We actually hear that it is now time that we begin as a people to realize that we have to target our laws, firstly our policies, and indeed our laws in the right manner. All right, so how do we move from here? There are so many countries around the world that came to understand that actually money is not created by government. It is created by banks. What have they done to go around it? Because the banking system globally, and perhaps even here, is to a large extent governed by rules that come from from Switzerland. And even here, our rules are themselves quite loose. They therefore sidestepped the so-called conventional wisdom of thinking that banks are intermediaries, and therefore took control of money. How did they take control? There are quite a number of ways in which they have taken control of the money. In Canada, for about 40 years, the government there used to build roads, bridges, airports, seaports, using sovereign money, money from the Bank of Canada. That's the central bank. Have we ever done this here? Of course not. What we do is we go to some bank somewhere and they say, well, okay, put a road between here, between Tshwane and Johannesburg, our people are going to pay. Germany did the same thing. Japan did the same thing. China and the Asian tigers recognized this, that the prerogative to create money is actually a state prerogative. And then they had to act.
So they make use, therefore, of their reserve bank. We do not make use of our reserve bank. Our reserve bank is purely for the sake of telling us after every 6 months we have to raise or decrease interest rate. The payment system that people have been talking about, and so on. It's almost a routine. People don't even question in this house, in Pretoria, and all around us. The state itself is misinformed. Right. These governments are mentioned here, understanding that the bank lobby is quite heavy, and we have bankers here, they know how to lobby, and they have money, after all, they create money. They had to find a way of sidestepping. But sometimes you just have to go head on and fight them, because you are state, you have the power vested in you for being that. Where do we start, therefore, in reforming our financial system, knowing that we must, at the end of the day, ensure that the country grows, one, the demographic composition changes, and the structural reforms in banking must be done. The starting point is our reserve bank. We find it must be subjected to democratic control. Not to push the footing around issues, Chair. The mandate of inflation targeting, or price stability, cannot be the be-it-all issue. We have, therefore, as a part of a deliberate act in this House, put up in place laws that are going to say price stability and unemployment must be your key target. They can do it. In fact, Japan, where they did, from 1945 onwards, that's why Japan became what it became to be. Their government, I mean their reserve bank, literally imposed on the government to do things that they should do.
A little warning, you've got less than 4 minutes.
Correct, thanks very much. So the parliament therefore must instruct, because there's no institutional set that thinks it is an institutional set, that can actually cannot be instructed by this House. It has been instructed that sovereign money must be created by the Reserve Bank and used for purposes of national development. Our state banks, land banks, DBSA, they go and borrow money and lend that money. It shouldn't be the case. State banks must get their money from the state itself, not from the taxpayers' money. Because government, Reserve Bank, create money from nothing. Therefore, the Reserve Bank has a duty to create money and give it to state banks, which therefore must ensure that that money is used for the purposes that this Parliament so dictates. I just want to remind the audience and honourable members that there was a teacher of economics at Cambridge University who made those remarks, that if a country cannot draw on its Reserve Bank, that country is a colony. That country is like a municipality. It has no power. And if that's the case, then let's accept that we are a colony of some sort. This teacher of economics is the only teacher of economics who models out the current mess that's happening in the EU. The disaster that we see there was modeled by this teacher of economics. Right. One important thing for those of us who are here as government. Here's a government officer in Canada who is echoing this statement that if government cannot control the issuance of money and credit, it can as well forget the so-called democracy. In fact, many people have lost hope in our democracy. Okay. He is responding. He would not recognize the importance of the power that we have as a state. So Mackenzie of Canada, who built roads and everything else using his Reserve Bank money, his echoing sentiments here, which are so profound. What do we do in this country? Chair, you asked about state banks. We're saying that beyond the Reserve Bank being told what to do by us, asking this house, not of course, this honorable method, that it has to be subject to democratic control, just like in China, in Brazil, and so on, we need to create state banks.
New policy banks need to be created. Public banks. Now, there's an issue of a black bank here. Our suggestion here is, if you create community banks in communities, those communities are going to own that. And those communities will be black, likely. So the creation of public banks in communities will therefore mean the banking system is owned by the communities. I'll give you an example. In Germany, 71% of the entire banking system in Germany is public banking. It's not private. We have big banks like Deutsche Bank, Community Bank, and so on. The market share, 13%. So 71% of the banking system in Germany is public. 75% of the banking system in India is public. Over 70% of the banking system in China is public. Are you wondering why China is leapfrogging all these economies? It's because we're in control of the banking system. We're not. Here, only four banks dictate what they want to do to us. In the UK, the poorest economy in the advanced economy is controlled by five banks. Let me finish off.
Alright.
So, Chair, let me just conclude in a second. What are we proposing? We're proposing the current big banks must exist. State banks must be created. Not for profit. I repeat this word, not for profit at all. This is what is happening in Germany, this is what is happening in India, this is what is happening in China, and so on. Municipal banks must be created, that should be state banks. Cooperative banks, Chair, you asked about it. Because credit can only be allocated by banks, because banks are the only persons who create money, we can only do so using state banks. That's why Germany is such a powerful economy today. That's why China is such a powerful economy. The issue of savings doesn't exist. The United States grew without savings at all. So did China and so on and so forth. The entire loan of funds doctrine, so we were taught, is a myth. It doesn't exist. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It was a very different approach, and that's always useful and refreshing. Thank you. Members, as you know, we only had the two towards the end, and so now, Chair, unless you want to make a comment, we can go straight into discussion. All right. So we can start with our discussion, and we can go on 3 minutes each if you need that time. Right hands, please. So there aren't any hands. Right. Honourable Topham. Yes. Honourable Poli Tobias. Honourable Lamini. Honourable Mkongi. There we are.
Chair, I'm going to qualify myself to the last present because when we were discussing the fiscal framework, I borrowed from the Chinese model in terms of how capital is generated. The Chinese model has the bigger chunk of capital being owned by the state. I elaborated that in my speech if you were listening to me last week. So I want us to discuss a model, an effective model of a state bank and cooperative bank, and get a presentation that will assist. Because my understanding is that banks should exist in communities. That's why earlier on I spoke about the need to focus on cooperative banks. Because I believe the services are more needed and capital will actually be generated and flow at that level. And given the challenges that we have of inclusive growth in South Africa, I want us to hear how then do we remodel our system to accommodate those basic needs that we have, including changing the demographics of ownership in Africa. That is the only question I have, Chair, and I will take you. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable. Yeah. Thank you, Honourable Tobias. Thank you, Honourable Topham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry, on the last presentation, I first saw money. I was a little bit confused at first, being a mere accountant. I don't understand things that are up in the air, like in Harry Potter land. So I googled your website and I read a little bit more, and then it made a lot more sense to me what you kind of put forward. And I submit to you that what you speak about has been done in other countries, and very recently Zimbabwe. If you have an unlimited monetary supply where you just print, the state effectively prints money, you'll create a hyperinflationary economy. So at the risk of getting an economic lecture on this, I mean, is that not what you're proposing, a hyperinflationary economy with no control over just print money?
Thank you very much. The Honourable Mkongi.
No, thank you very much. The challenge that we're facing in South Africa is when the entire financial sector doesn't show interest into the development trajectory of the country. For example, there is an issue that we have put in your last definancialization of our own economy in relation to the industrial drive of South Africa. That has been accepted by government. But you find that the
I don't want to talk to the same folks again about respecting the speaker on the floor. Honourable Mkongi?
Yes, especially to Mr. Ngosi, is that what actually do you suggest that should be elements and instruments to definancialize the South African economy? Because when you suggest all these banks that must go up and to the local level, for me, you still stay in the financialization drive of the country in relation to industrialization of the country. Because what I understand that these banks should focus at funding developmental projects of the country. Now we're talking about Operation Pakisa, Ocean Economy, and so forth. You see limited interest on that. It is government who builds roads here, who builds infrastructure, and there's limited input from the financial sector. So if you talk about definancialization of our economy in relation to industrialization, what are the key instruments that you need to put in place in order to achieve such a goal?
Thank you, Honourable Mkongi. Honourable Dlamini.
No, mine is very simple. You spoke a lot of what the banks don't do and our assumption that we think is what the bank does. I didn't get you on your own explanation on, okay, what do the banks do? That's what I want to get to, because you've told us of what they don't do. What is it that they do?
Thank you very much. Now, please, Mr. Ngosi, you ready? Thank you.
Thanks, Chairperson. Let me start with the honourable person who talks about Zimbabwe and the inflation. With due respect, you don't understand money. You don't understand banking at all. Right? You don't and you not, and you better listen when people come here honorably to address this honorable house. $29.616 trillion was printed by the US government in the past 2 years. Where is inflation? They're suffering deflation there. In the EU, trillions upon trillions of dollars are being printed. Euros are being printed. Where's the inflation? The mismanagement of Zimbabwe should not confuse. And please, if you're not informed, seek information. All right? You are not informed. I wanted to get rid of that. It shouldn't confuse people in this country about Zimbabwe and so on and so forth. It's time you learn and we all become disciplined as to what we're informing this country. Thank you.
Chair. Just a point of caution. I think it is important that whether it's institutions or members of the public, those coming before this honourable house to make presentations, they do so in a very dignified manner. I mean, otherwise you don't have to listen to them, you know. So just saying, if they think they know too much,
they might as well find a better place to make a presentation and save MPs some time. Very important, we are elected to be here. We didn't get a master's degree to be here. It's by way of a cross, and that cross must be respected.
Yeah, I think it works both ways, that you respect. It's something people should look at carefully. Can I just finish? Because I on the finance committee, we've raised this bullet. You see, there are some things that you know better than I do, right? For example, when Ma Shope Setole spoke, she's a veteran, right? Okay, in Europe, if you're 85 years old or you're 17 years old as a new MP, you have the same status, right? Without throwing the cultural card, who am I compared to somebody like you? The truth is there should be some deference also for somebody like Ma Setole. The sniping when she spoke was unacceptable. If I was chatting on my own with finance committee members, I would have demanded an apology. It's the first thing to say. The second thing to say is that, you see, it's not fair, I've raised this before, Pule, that this issue about Dr. Baloyi is in the public domain, so you have to accept that it's going to come up. Right, that's fine. But the key to getting raped, right, and there are limits to also that, given the gender and racial and cultural sensitivities of our country. So the rules are not done in an abstract way, and each chair and the two of us will just handle it in a different way. So I do agree, sir, Mr. Nkosi, that maybe your tone was unacceptable, but you know what? On the whole, his tone was far less severe and irritable than members have been towards others. So quite frankly, my own view is, yes, Pule is right, but yes, too. There's one final thing to say. I've raised this before in the Finance Committee. I recognize the immunities and privileges thing, but it's also true that in this House, and in the House, say, this committee, and in that House, a member can say anything and everything. It's true we are protected. But there are things we can say that could be factually wrong. Or people's grandchildren are listening to these things and so on. So we need to balance these sensitivities out. While recognizing the robustness, I've pleaded with the DA members in the Finance Committee and have failed, but I'm just saying this remains my view. You, Shivambu Floyd, are in that Rules Committee. It has to be some sort of tempering, you know, there's not abstract rules. So what I'm saying is, we must have a robust debate. I think you were slightly overboard. But for hitting back, frankly, I think you did the right thing. That's my thing.
Thanks for your protection. But thanks, Ndatimabi. Honorable member from the EFF asked a question around what the banks do. I've said what they don't do. What the banks do. Banks, the fundamental role is basically to issue security, in short. All they do is to exchange the security for another. That's their primary business. And as part of that, they create this money supply that we use in this country. But also, apart from creating it, they allocate it as well. And they choose who to give it to. Just like your colleague, Shivam, was talking about the credit creation and the allocation of it. Precisely, that's what they do. That's why this economy cannot grow, because they're just choosing a few people to allocate the money. And that's why banks elsewhere, they did quantitative easing. Its correct name is quantitative monetary easing. So they sent that money into the productive sector, to answer his question, and created products, roads, this and that, and so on and so forth. But then our banks, these banks, our private banks, before, when they create that money, they want it's debt money, all right? They want you and me to get it from them, and they charge us so much. Hence, therefore, the creation of state banks should be for non-profit purposes, just as it is happening in China, as it is happening in Germany. All the 71% of the economic system there is actually public bank. And why can't South Africa have it when 90% of the banking system here is private, when we should in fact be having it public, especially as a developing country? We need it. Definancialization, I partly tried to answer this thing.
21% of this economy is in the financial sector. All right? Study after study has revealed that beyond 7% of this sector's contribution to GDP, this sector begins to suck the economic air in the country. And the rest of the productive sector cannot breathe and it collapses. That's why today, I must admit, I was working for government. So I do understand in a key economic ministry. All right? So I do understand how the industrial sector has been suffocated by the banking sector. That's why today the manufacturing sector is not as high as it was yesterday. So all these small banks that we have to create, public banks, should actually be targeted towards the productive sector. In fact, one of the regulations that perhaps include is ban speculative issuance of credit by these banks, because that encourages financialization. So when these small banks in China, in India, and everywhere else are created, they're targeted, they're told by the state, you are going to do green economy. You are going to do manufacturing at a low industrial level, high level, and so on and so forth. And with that, therefore, you are killing the financialization. That would be my quick response. It's a rather difficult question to answer in a short space of time that I've been given. But the model I try to present here is a case where we have a set of banks in the communities, owned by the communities, that become public. They can be supported by state. You know, stock fraud like, you know, people, money put together, a bank is authorized. They don't have the capital ratio adequacies that the Basel Committee is putting for that strangle these banks. You have to put rules that are different. Definitely in Germany, in no other places. So therefore, we have to say we have local banks. If they are localized, they are owned by those people who are hiring one at home in those places. Right. Now, we come at municipality level. We also create state banks, if we can. All right. But even at policy banks, at the national level, we create also state banks. But these banks, Metobias, they don't have to go to the open market to go and look for money. Money must be handed to them by the Reserve Bank. It's free money. The Reserve Bank creates money without even, it doesn't cost it a cent. That's what Canada did. Canada is not Zimbabwe at all. That's Australia did the same thing. I can name any advanced country today through our research. They did this thing, but they don't want us to do it. We can't. It's one of the this economy. Sorry, thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Shivambu.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. Just quick, you know, I want to consider what they're saying. But we don't know who you are. And we don't know who you are, and this first source money, virtually all of us are hearing about it for the first time. What is first source money? What do you do? Where do you come from? Who do you work with? Because we try to check the website, the only person who's identified there is you. There's no any other person that, there's no board or some sense of institutional integrity and structure. Which ministry did you work for? Where do you come from? Like, what is your story? We must listen to all of those things so that we're able to locate your arguments properly. But now you're speaking, I was trying to understand, what is this first source money coming from? What does it do? And what integrity does it have to could give authoritative information in the manner in which you are trying to do now? Please tell us about your general condition in the program.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, Honorable Shivambu, because we're all just wondering, are you similar to Mr. de Kock, you know, an individual out there who studied this, analyzed it, etc., and sharing your personal point of view? Or are you some form of institution, corporate, or firm? Because we can't seem to get a handle on you.
I hope you're not going to answer like Mr. Peacock. I'm suffering from a conflicted identity. He says, I'm speaking for myself, I don't represent anybody. But at the same breath, he'll say, I speak for the man, meaning the person in the street. So we're not sure whether he speaks for himself or he speaks for the 53 million people of the country. I'm going to resist teasing you, right? Sivas? Never mind.
Thanks very much.
Honorable Sivas?
To make a follow-up question on the model of the cooperatives, I think we have, I wanted to say.
Would this be addressed to First Thought?
Yes.
All right.
Somebody please ask Mr.
Sivas, if he may have
been
with
you.
Yeah.
One, but it's just that... Chairperson,
yeah,
didn't check.
Yeah.
Right, Honorable
Tabai. Thank you, Chair. I would want to have a comment from First of Money about what is his opinion about the current model of our cooperatives. Then, because I have an impression that there's policy limitations in terms of how they can generate more capital. I might be wrong. That's the impression I get from individual members of CIS when they engage us as public representatives. So they believe we should loosen our legislative framework to accommodate them to grow. I might be wrong. I'm not an economist, and unlike other people. So I'm trying to make sense of everything. Can
you just... Thanks, Chair. Honorable Shivam. I worked for the Department of Trade and Industry. I can see one of my colleagues is here, is a banker. We used to work together in the same section, Mr. Mfundonkosi. Right. I also worked for Transnet and the Siyabonga Gama, well, that. I work for the Department of Transport as well, South African Maritime Safety Authority. Yeah, for much of this time. FESOS, what I'm telling you, FESOS is, I think you have received the written submission. They've got four persons there who are head, it's not there. No, the written submission, the actual word, in the word document.
Joe. Now you can see how important it is that we get it.
Well, I just mailed last week. So it is.
That was sent out by email.
Yeah. So you get that information from there. So there is definitely institutional integrity there. So we have four persons who, one is here in Cape Town, in Durban, and in Pretoria, Johannesburg. So yeah, that's fair source. Like I said, we specialize in money, banking and macroeconomics. That's our specialty. Hence, we have this sort of authority. Yes. When I looked at
Chair, and then what do you do? Who pays you? You are just four, and then you just
are you
a institution?
We're a non-governmental organization. We actually solicit funding from various organizations. We are open. So. Not yet, in fact.
So we're now getting dialogue. Please, let's just get the response.
All right, so should I go direct to Honorable Tobias?
Yes.
Yeah. When I had gone to the Treasury to check up on the, to discuss issues of cooperatives, I found that some of the regulations there were not as friendly. Issues of capital and the numbers, of course, of people that have to be in there, and quite a number of areas, the governance of it, the governance structure, is not particularly useful. What we have done ourselves, the issues which we want to present to Treasury, is to give them our view of how they should be governed, so that they ain't as onerous as we see them today ourselves. So if there's going to be indeed an acceptance by country that we should move towards cooperatives and other sort of banks, then we're going to have to give our view as to how some of the regulations that are there have to be reviewed, just as much as we have to offer regulations around how land bank operates. We think, again, that problem. So yes, the regulatory framework is a bit hard for our cooperatives.
Right. Perhaps to just your
yourself then, Mr. de Kock. You also comment on cooperative banking and the like, but you seem to suggest that perhaps we should pursue the Stockfel, CFIs and Isuzu West African model. You don't seem to link cooperative banking to the mainstream banking sector per se, as perhaps your colleague on the left of you. That's one issue. The other one is the point you make about decent work, I think it is, somewhere. Oh, yeah, number 8. You speak about opportunities for shared value, and then you go on to expanding the missing middle and so on and so forth. But I don't really see the points being made here about, you know, you refer often in the papers to the United Nations, the sustainability goals, etc., but also there's the ILO, which had a linkage there. I would have liked to have heard a bit more about your decent work and economic growth. Very little here. Thanks.
Thank you, Mrs. Chair. I really appreciate your questions. Chair, on your first question, do I see the cooperative banking as part of banking? Yes, I see as part of the mainstream banking. The question is, do we need a different business model for cooperative banks? Yes, I think that's true. Secondly, we cannot ask on the one hand and talk about things like anti-money laundering and FICA that we don't or haven't discussed here today. And then we say, on the other hand, we don't want rules or regulations. But I think what we and that's why I'm saying, I'm looking at actually at synergy, that all people come together, government as well as private sector, as well as the big bank, and say, what must the new business model of cooperative banking be? And if it is that some of the bigger banks or some of the bigger organizations can actually become part of that, the third tier or second tier, third tier, then it's B. But to say from my side and think that there is one model and that's the only model for cooperative banking, that's not the case, because there is no one bank that can work for South Africa. We can use examples and we can say, but why is it working in Africa and why is it working in India and why is the whole cooperative bank or the credit unions or even the savings bank in Germany or in Canada so big? That's the kind of research that I think we must also look in, because transformation for me is always work in progress. We can never stop and say we have achieved transformation or we have achieved inclusive all our people. Because what can happen is that people can have, as you quite correctly state, that they can have not even bank accounts, but they can still work. The question is, what do they do with their money? Or lastly, unbankable people can be people that has, or people that sometimes people have bank accounts, but they're not credit worthy. So what we are looking for is unique models for South Africa and unique tools for South Africa that is available, but it must be adopted to South Africa. Because if it was that easy, then your question is, why is it not already in South Africa? So what I'm saying is work in progress, and we want to put all the resources together and pull in one direction. So we cannot exclude one stakeholder or one party.
Members, as you know, Chairperson Karim, Honourable Hill Lewis, has actually suggested earlier, proposed that the individual banks could come in at this point with a couple of minutes each. I'm just trying to identify the banks here who are still with us.
see Barclay is here. Standard Bank was here a minute ago. Is First Rand here? And yes, right.
Shall we start with Barclay? You want to see something quickly? Obviously, it's your initial responses, and you will get a chance to respond. You want to say something there, my friend? The lady's glasses.
We're just waiting for CEO to come back in the room.
All right. Does anybody else want to respond for now? No. Well, say hello. Fine. No, now you're not sharing. We have got time. It was a good idea, and we were going to suggest it anyway. No, no. The button decided to forego replying, right? Okay. In that case, then we draw to a close. I hand over to you. Yeah.
Well, as you can see, we the banks were given that opportunity, but perhaps for obvious reasons, they may have decided to wait until their written submission to supplement what they have already said here verbally or shared with us. But I do think the financial services industry and therefore its transformation is critical to our country, because it offers us the opportunity to address the socio-economic injustices that the earlier or historical political measures and legislation put forward. And I believe it will only work effectively and be successful if the private sector here with the public sector recognizes this and takes the decision to accelerate this transformation, and that we do so speedily, recognizing that it is now 23 years since 94 and very little has changed of substance in the financial sector. We've already heard even admissions that the top structure in the financial institutions really remain, don't get transformed demographically or indeed take into account the gender issue either. So I think that that's an acknowledgement from yourselves, and the issue of unencumbered acquisition of assets when it comes to the financial sector. Some of you have commented on, and others have not. But we do have to address it very, very seriously. And I want to thank Chairperson Karim for recognizing the relationship that trade and industry has with this area. And you heard that earlier this morning with broad-based black economic empowerment addressed as the financial charter by DTI Mr. Tito. And I think that that was, for me, certainly, and I know trade and industry, but I also hope for the Standing Committee on Finance members informative. And I do want to thank you, Chairperson Karim. But you may wish to add, as to remind members what is happening tomorrow, that is the illicit financial transfers, which we called transfer pricing.
All right, thanks. Firstly, just some clarity. You'll notice NetBank did not appear today because we did not want the big four banks to overdominate. And the decision with NetBank wasn't a subjective one. We had to pick it out of a hat, as it were. And with NetBank's fortunate or unfortunate outcome that they fell there. Secondly, we are encouraging individuals to speak. There was some vague discussion about whether we should give individuals 10 minutes, and structures 15 minutes. If you look at who BASA represents and we look at, but we decided no, everybody, whoever it is, as isolated as they may be, if they can make their way or get funded to be here, should speak at the same time. So, you know, what we've done though, is you'll see there was a clustering, because there have been questions being raised about why things to perform they did. Actually, it's very objective, and where it was subjective, it is an outcome of a toss of a coin.
All right, then to also explain that those of you who are here, who are going to appear on the 22nd, can you please ensure that by Friday this week, you submitted your slide presentations. Can we send a notice out? And can the Trade Ministry please send out a notice for illicit financial flows? It will inform the Minerals Committee, your committee, Comrade Joe, and ours, three committees. It's a focus largely on involving a program of action, a joint program of action, and one that each committee, Trade Ministry on its own, ourselves with finance on our own, and Minerals on its own must do. So we've called in, you will recall it flows from the last meeting. We've insisted that the SAPS be here. They must tell us what they're doing on illicit financial flows. We've asked for the NPA to be here to tell us, have they got the experience, expertise, give us figures of the number of people they've put into the process. So it's not going to be an abstract discussion. We had four discussions before on what is illicit financial flow, is VEPS legal or illegal, what is the relationship? No, no, no. You look at the program, the three chairs agreed on it. It's a program about action. And at the end of it, we must have a program of ourselves as parliamentary committees, but what we're going to do to ensure the executive, the NPA, SAPS, SARS, everybody does their job, and how often are we going to hold them before our committees individually and collectively over the next three, until 2019 at least. Okay, so please, let's not have fights about what are we meeting for. I mean, obviously, Mr. Mayan knew everything, even discussing over the phone, but he might have won a lot of few votes, which is a good thing. Now, don't come here tomorrow and tell us what is this meeting about, right? And don't tell us you haven't got your program, Trade and Industry Committee Secretary. We sent it out on Friday together with the documentation. Also, to be fair, the documentation doesn't come from the Standing Committee on Finance. In fact, it's your committee, John. What's this guy's name?
Mr. Herman.
Martin Nicol, is it? Mr. Nicol?
Mr. Herman.
No, the guy who researched it, the one that did the paper. So Antonio Manemela and maybe the minister. What we are saying is, we send out from our side by email to the respective committee secretaries simultaneously. So can we sort this out separately from the meeting tomorrow? Everybody got it at exactly the same time I got it, which was last week, sometime, Antonio, is that right? Last week? Well, it's with your committee secretary, sort that out. Thank you very much. Thank you very, very much to all of you who turned up here today, especially those of you who stayed till the very end. We regret that some of you came later in the day, but you know how to manage the media, right? So you can manage the media. Thank you very much. You sent your statements out long before you came here. Thank you very much.
your documentation.
What do you mean?